Ever feel like you just missed out on something amazing? With BBC Sounds, you can ask most smart speakers to go back to the start of the show. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart. So you never miss a thing again.
Coming up next, Friday Night Comedy.
Get more from your smart speaker with BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday the 30th of August. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. The Prime Minister has told the BBC that anyone convicted of an unlawful killing, which includes all forms of manslaughter, will be exempt from the prison early release scheme in England and Wales. In an exclusive interview with BBC Breakfast, Andy Burnham said the changes would keep hundreds of people behind bars, including the killers of PC Andrew Harper. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
Andy Burnham faced his toughest political test yet when it emerged that two of PC Andrew Harper's killers would be eligible for early release. The Prime Minister had already expanded the list of those not eligible to include some rapists and child sex offenders. He had suggested he couldn't go any further, but under pressure from victims' families, changed his mind. He told BBC Breakfast that hundreds more people would now stay behind bars.
Not just those guilty of manslaughter, but those convicted for indecent assault, for death by dangerous driving, all of these offenders now will remain in prison.
The Justice Secretary is expected to give a more precise number of prisoners affected when he updates MPs in Parliament on Tuesday. Mr. Burnham said he would free up space on the prison estate by deporting foreign criminals and releasing people on controversial indefinite sentences handed out in previous decades under public protection rules. But those measures will not create extra space for some time, meaning adult male prisons, currently operating at around 98% capacity, could get even busier.
More than 730 people are now known to have died in Nepal after Wednesday's devastating flash floods. Officials say around 2,500 people are still missing, and rescue teams are warning that search efforts are being hampered by the rain. Our South Asia correspondent, Azadeh Mashiri, reports from Kathmandu.
The forecast suggests the rain will continue until at least tomorrow, adding to an already challenging search and rescue operation. Many remain trapped in hydropower tunnels in northern Nepal, and thick mud is blocking rescuers from entering them. India and China have both sent experts to help. With hundreds of foreign nationals missing, aid is continuing to pour in. The United States has pledged $3.6 million in humanitarian assistance, while the United Kingdom has sent a rapid deployment team to Nepal to support British nationals.
The Chinese state broadcaster says that 16 people are now confirmed to have died in Tibet. More than 500 others are still missing. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
Chinese state media reported that among the 546 people missing after Wednesday's landslide, 261 are foreigners, including 15 British nationals. Search and rescue teams are combing through mud and debris at the border, but have so far found no survivors. Meanwhile, the danger posed by a lake, which formed amid the landslide debris, appears to have subsided for now. However, authorities say there's still a continued risk of further mudslides and have set up monitoring stations to alert rescue teams along the border.
Rescue teams have been working through the night after a vessel with five people on board was reported to be in distress off the coast of Plymouth. A helicopter, a plane and lifeboats were involved in the operation in the channel. NASA is due to launch a new telescope later, which the space agency says will help it study more than a billion galaxies. The first images from the Nancy Grace Roman space telescope are expected early next year. Here's our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
Dr. Nancy Grace Roman was warned off physics by teachers who told her it was not for girls. She ignored them and went on to become NASA's first chief astronomer in 1960. Soon, her namesake will be a million miles from Earth, scanning the skies with Hubble, the space telescope she made possible. The Roman Space Telescope has a mirror the same size as Hubble's, but its camera has a wider field of view, so sees at least 100 times more sky at once. Its five-year mission is to map more than a billion galaxies.
The Chancellor, John Healey, is in North Carolina, where he'll attend a meeting of G20 finance ministers and central bank governors. On his first foreign trip as Chancellor, he'll meet key figures from the International Monetary Fund and his counterparts from countries including the US, China and India. And the British boxer Moses Atauma has failed in his attempt to become the youngest heavyweight world champion since Mike Tyson in 1986. The 21-year-old was beaten by Croatia's Filip Hrgović in their IBF title last night in London. Here's the moment Atauma was knocked out in the ninth round.
The action resumes, and a left hook from Filip Hrgović sends Moses Atauma to the canvas. We have a new IBF heavyweight champion of the world. Filip Hrgović has made history.
BBC News.
Later this week, Radio 4 goes back in time.
Normanday on BBC Radio 4.
A special day of programmes celebrating the return of the Bayeux Tapestry to the UK.
Starting the day live at the British Museum and a sneak peek at their landmark exhibition.
After that, leading thinkers and writers debate the enduring impact of this period of history.
We'll also be finding out what life was like for women during and after the Norman Conquest. And then,
I want to ask the question, what did the Normans do for our diet?
Exploring the lasting legacy of the Norman Conquest.
Norman Day, this Thursday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And the special day includes the food historian Dr. Annie Gray, considering how the Norman Conquest changed what we eat and drink. That's in the food programme on Thursday morning at 11. In half an hour, we'll be visiting the National Trust Wallington Estate in Northumberland to explore changes to both farming and tenancies. That's in On Your Farm at 6:35. But now on Radio 4, it's Heart and Soul. And this week we're in Jamaica and hearing from Kurt Henry, part of the community's revivalists who worked to secure UNESCO recognition for a religious practice that's long been misunderstood and marginalised.
Jamaica has given the world a lot of cultural gifts, be it reggae music, be it Rastafari. And I say with pride that revivalism is the only religion that came from the people of Jamaica. And that is something to be proud of.
Jamaican revivalism's a glorious mashup, a blend of rhythms and beliefs that's part Christianity, part ancestral spirituality.
Our bodies are used as instruments. You'll have the deep guttural sound, right? And then you have the stamping of the feet. Groaning in the spirit is one of that complex ways that we use to communicate with the spirit.
Their annual pilgrimage to Wat Town is a journey to revivalism's most sacred of sites.
Wat Town serves as that spiritual center that brings you back to the basics, that brings you back to the core.
That's Kurt Henry. He's a revivalist who believes that the spirits guide him through life.
There are spirits dwelling among us. The temporal and the spiritual worlds are one. My own spiritual journey started when I started having particular dreams and experiences. My mother would tell me stories of communicating with spiritual beings at a tender age, at about 6 or 7, thereabout. A revival leader looked at me and said to her that he's one of us.
Those childhood experiences, they set Kurt on his life mission to preserve the past and to secure the future of Jamaican revivalism.
I began to shed the stereotypes that I've always been hearing about revivalism, that it is uncivilized, you know, it is demonic worship, it's devil worship and so on. And at the end, I decided fully that I am going to be a revivalist. And here I am today.
I'm Nick Davis, and for Heart and Soul, we're in Jamaica to meet Kurt Henry and explore his unique religion with its roots buried deep in the island's ancestral history.
What marks you out as a revivalist?
When you ask the average revivalist, you know, how did you come into this religious practice? They will tell you that either my grandmother or my great-grandmother was a revivalist. I learned from my grand-aunt, right? I grew with her partially, so I was exposed to her everyday interactions with the spirit, you know, her wearing particular colors and uniforms, and the deep belief that she had in the use of clothing as a way of healing. So, for example, whenever she had a headache, she would wrap her head in the red turban, and then you'd hear her saying that the headache is gone and so on. Her communication with angels, so at certain time of the day, she would wear a particular uniform, or you could know when a particular angel is present in the house, you know, based on the color that she would wear at that particular time. So I grew up around that sort of levity, you know, where revivalism is concerned.
As a child, my own grandmother performed the revivalist rituals passed down to her through the generations.
I think one of the key tenets of this religious practice is ancestral lineage or connection to the movement. There's that sort of bloodline connection, right? That's one aspect. Like Rastafari, I consider revivalism to be a levity. It is a way of life. It is not simply just going to church, you know.
It's not the light switch.
It's not. It's not at all. It's what you live every day. So you may have revivalists having altars in their homes, that spiritual identity, that spiritual connectivity that you have within your daily life.
Today, Kurt Henry teaches university students about Jamaican cultural history.
I refer to myself as a scholar practitioner of revivalism. I am also the director of the African Caribbean Institute of Jamaica, Jamaica Memory Bank, that is responsible for documenting and researching African cultural heritage.
Which came first, your research or your faith?
My faith.
Okay.
In fact, I was never baptized in a revival church. I was baptized in a Seventh-day church. But upon leaving that church, I would always immediately go to a revival church for that sort of spiritual fulfillment that I was not getting in the Seventh-day Church. Later on in my life, I attended the University of the West Indies, and the opportunity came for me to pursue doctoral studies.
Kurt is almost the exact opposite of me. He's tall and slim and in his early 30s, and with his manicured beard and round glasses and dark jacket, he looks every inch the academic.
I knew that I wanted to pursue an area in revivalism. So my thesis looked specifically on clothing, the religious and the cultural significance of clothing. But not only clothing, but also how clothing is deployed on the body in ritual spaces and how meanings are generated from that. And my doctoral studies, it was also a journey of self-discovery.
That journey of self-discovery leads Kurt to what he believes was his destiny, to gain recognition for the cultural and global significance of revivalism from UNESCO.
I was a part of a team that was able to have revivalism being inscribed on UNESCO's intangible cultural heritage lists of humanity. There's also a sense of humility, you know, in knowing that I was strategically positioned by my ancestors to be able to do this sort of work in allowing the movement that has been marginalized for many years to finally get that sense of recognition and validity among the nation. I would say it was predetermined because looking back at my life now, there are other paths that I would have taken. But as destiny would allow it, I was taken on the path that I'm supposed to be, you see? And that is where the humility comes. By submitting yourself to that will of a higher power, you see, that serves as a kind of guide.
Kurt's now dedicated to rebranding revivalism, not as something occultish from the past, but as a living, breathing faith from ancestral Africa, practiced by tens of thousands of Jamaicans today.
I lecture a course in African religious retentions, and I always begin my class by asking this: what do you think of revivalism? And much of what they say to me are stories that they have heard. Once I take them on a field trip to visit a revival church, the responses are very different. Sir, I did, what I've been hearing, I didn't experience that in the movement, right?
How would it play out normally? Is there a structure?
There is an order for revival services, but the reliance, the direction of the service has to do with the spirit. You do have praying, reading of the scriptures, importantly chanting, or what we call drilling, right? Which is a communal way of communing with each other and also the spirit. You do have exhortations, testimony sessions, and so on. But the difference is the fundamental reliance on the spirit during our services, and the spirit, as see fit, can intervene at any point in time.
How does your faith, how does that liberty present itself in your everyday life?
You know, certain rituals, fasting and prayer and so on. Chanting is an everyday ritual. And it's a way of maintaining that sort of spiritual grounding as we continue on our journey.
Kurt's our guide to revivalism, to the Wat Town pilgrimage, and to the extraordinary ceremonies that happen high in the mountain parish of St. Anne on the first day of March every year.
Why Wat Town?
Many years ago, in the 1800s, there was a revival leader who would have gotten a vision from the spirit to use that site as the spiritual center for revivalists. There were testimonies of revivalists across the island getting similar visions to go to that specific site. And over time, Wat Town got what I would say, prominence, as one of the spiritual sites in Jamaica for revivalism. Revivalism is centered on community. Is centered on the idea of healing and togetherness. The Jamaican revival emerged in the early 1860s, a few years after emancipation. And this was a period within which you had missionaries coming to the island to Christianize slaves. And of course, African Jamaicans at that time used that as an opportunity to not only incorporate Christian elements, but also use that as an opportunity to revisit their African cultural practices. Those practices that they were not allowed by law to practice on the plantations.
What was it which came from West Africa to inform this practice?
The Africans that came to Jamaica, there were several spiritual traditions and practices that came with them. So there wasn't a unified religious or spiritual tradition per se. What I can say is that the Africans that came here predominantly with the Yoruba traditions, the Yoruba practices. They believe in the ancestral realm, they believe in the divine being, the belief in the pantheon of spirits. They're all coming from a Yoruba tradition. The revivalism that you experience today is as a result of the formal influence of Christianity and the incorporation of the spiritualities from the indentured laborers that would have come after slavery. So we're looking at the East Indians, we're looking at the Chinese, and also the Africans that came from the Congo region.
But at that time, if slaves were caught practicing African spiritualism, they risked brutal punishment.
There were nocturnal gatherings happening right throughout slavery. Enslaved people found hills and valleys, generally marginal spaces, to continue transferring knowledges of their religion and so on. They, in that time, used the opportunity, in secret, of course, to, as best as they can, preserve these religious practices.
Kurt's faith was driven deep underground. Even after emancipation, the revival movement was feared as taboo. It's a miracle that anything's left today.
There is this sort of ignorance around revivalism. Mm-hmm. But there is also the factor of fear. I've seen a bill in 1931 that was proposed to the colonial government at the time, prohibiting the practice of revivalism on the grounds that it contributed to mental insanity. At that time in Jamaica's history, there was a rise in the numbers of persons being committed to the mental asylum. A significant amount of that were black people.
You just really touched on a nerve for a second, because my grandma was institutionalized at Bellevue.
But if I may say, though, that revivalism actually contributed to the reverse. Because Jamaicans have been using spirituality to cope with the harsh realities of plantation systems that would have caused inherent trauma that we are still recovering from today. While our bodies were shackled, but our spirits were not. And it is a spirit that has kept Africans and African Jamaicans alive even to this very day.
It created such a problem for Africans and faith for the colonial powers.
This is a group of people that have gone through verbal abuse, physical abuse. They have gone through instances of mutilation. They have faced ridicule. They have been beaten. They have been raped. They have been torn from families. Spirit within revivalism give us a sort of energy, you know, to push through difficult situations. And that is one of the main factors that has allowed the movement to survive until today.
Watt Town is a twisting couple of hours' drive from my home in Kingston. And on this day each year, this is where revivalists gather to climb a winding hill path.
It starts at the foot of the hill, where you will see a sign with Psalm 24 on it. And what happens is that revivalists would line up in a single file and they would repeat that psalm. After repeating that psalm, they would then progress up the hill with a hymn. After you're done chanting here, then you'll proceed to the top of the hill where the leaders of Watt Town would receive you. That's referred to as the registration. Registration meaning you allow the messengers or the spirit to know that you are present at the site.
A man skips up a near vertical shortcut with a basket balanced on his head. There's food and drink and a plant with dark green leaves and almost day-glow veins of orange and yellow.
The croton plant is significant in Jamaica's folk philosophy because croton is regarded by West Africans as a sort of sacred plant. And the croton plant, in fact, was used by enslaved Africans in the Caribbean to mark their burial spots. So for us, it's a sort of sacred plant that is used within our rituals.
Pilgrims carry satchels and workbooks with pencils tucked into the folds of their turbans. And their leaders beat time with what looks like a long wooden ruler.
That is referred to as a yardstick. A yardstick is a symbol of authority. What he has is a notebook in his hand along with the yardstick. And that notebook is a spiritual emblem where he would write what I refer to as spirit writings within that notebook. So messages that he would get from the spirit, he would then record that in the notebook. And the notebook and the pencil refer to the sort of idea or metaphor that revivalists are children going to a spiritual school.
Each church group or band wears their own colours, and it's an incredible sight.
The colours are important because the colours represent the particular messengers or message that you have taken to what town. So you wear the uniform as a sort of tribal mark, per se, or an identity of the community that you are a part of. The uniform serves as a form of spiritual protection. You know, the uniforms are usually consecrated before they are worn.
Men and women wear brightly coloured turbans, tunics, trousers and dresses. It's a sea of yellows and reds, blues and greens, and the band nearest to me now, they're in purple.
This is burgundy that's being worn, right? Burgundy in revivalism is referred to as the Maroon Order, which, of course, those enslaved Africans that would have escaped slavery and formed free villages within the mountains, right? So they're what we refer to as nations in revivalism. And oftentimes these colours are worn to represent those nations. Some of the revivalists at Watton wearing Madras, the Madras plaid.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is from the East Indians who would have come to the island. And of course, during that era, the early 1840s, they incorporated the Madras. Because remember now that before colonialism, Indians were trading with Africans long before. So the Africans who came were already familiar with the Madras fabric. So it was easy for them to incorporate it within their everyday practices.
Each band stops before the final push to circle a small flagpole.
They will go in a circle, in an anti-clockwise motion, symbolizing that African philosophy around the continuity of life, symbolizing the belief in community. Within that circle, you have what we call the band's leader. That person within the center of the bands is the one that at that point communicating with the spirit. And what happens is that those on the periphery would then look at the one in the center and mimic the movement. So there's that call and response in bodily movements, as well as sounds that are being made. And it is through that sort of musical chant that you then begin to, as we say, journey in the spiritual realm.
There are chalk symbols marked in the ground.
These markings are referred to as seals, which are a sort of point of departure to communicate with the other side, with the spirit world and so on. And within these seals, there are codes, there are messages. So once you begin to drill and to chant on these markings, they are then unlocked to reveal certain messages coming from the spirit world. And it's also a part of the coding system of revivalism. There's always been that perception that what the colonizers don't know, they can't destroy.
The air's filled with a joyous sound clash as the pilgrims drill to open themselves to receive the spirits.
And then there is a crescendo or a build-up, and there are times when they would rest, rest singing for a while and begin to chant. So you'll hear the guttural sounds, movement of the feet and so on. It is believed that emphasis is placed on the groaning. Because it is actually the groaning that will then take you through the spiritual realms. The groaning serves as a sort of guide or compass that allows you to move through the spirit world.
Inside the chapel is hot. The atmosphere is electric. You can almost feel it in the air. Worship the Lord. Praise
there's an intensity as it relates to the spiritual connection that you feel, the energies that are coming out from the colors that are being worn, from the various spirits that are present or messengers that are present in the place.
Leaders are preaching from the front as a constant revolving congregation responds to their calls.
In the chapel, there's actually a service going on. And that service is punctuated by the receiving of bands. So whenever a band is done registering, they would then proceed in the church to let me say, the messengers or the spirits that reside in the church to also let those spirits be aware that they are present on the site. So there's a sort of spirit work happening in the church and that sort of spiritual anticipation for the bands that are then being received in the church.
Calls and shouts go up as the spirits speak. Spontaneous dancing in circles breaks out as people chant and praise God.
Turning the anti-clockwise turning is symbolic in terms of removing whatever malevolent forces that may be around you or unwelcome spirits that may be troubling with you, so that anti-clockwise turning of the body is to get rid of that sort of negative aura or energy around you.
Because of the work done by Kurt and the team, it got UNESCO recognition. The significance of the Wat Town pilgrimage will never be forgotten.
There is a way in which African cultural practices are seen as mere entertainment. And it is okay to take it on stage. It is okay to sit, you know, and watch a performance. But once one gets too close to experiencing it, to acknowledging the philosophy and really the spirituality of it, then there is some sort of withdrawal where that is concerned. It's coming out of the era of colonization where Africans were taught to stay away from those practices. They were stripped of their identity. They were stripped of their language and cultural practices. Revivalism itself, as this religious movement, has also evolved. So revivalism started out with everyday working class people. And today you have people within very high spaces in society, influential spaces, who are now revivalists. You have revivalists who are doctors, lawyers, and so on, who are working to also push the movement forward in terms of a national recognition and in terms of its legitimacy. Revivalism cannot simply be regarded as a Christian denomination. It is too complex than that. So there are elements of Christianity, there are elements of African spirituality, there are elements of Hinduism, elements of Chinese spirituality. So revivalism for me is not a Christian denomination. It has elements of Christianity. With great pride, I say that revivalism is a folk religion that came from the people of Jamaica.
Heart and Soul was presented by Nick Davis and produced by Matt O'Donoghue. Ahead of next month's National Suicide Memorial Day for health and care workers, Phylon 4 investigates the reality of doctors at risk of suicide.
Here's a shocking statistic, one you may not be aware of. According to the BMA, one doctor dies by suicide every 3 weeks.
We need a national strategy for learning from deaths.
I'm Dr. Lalit Vijayadoru, and I'm exploring what's being done to tackle it and why it's happening in the first place. Hearing stories of bullying, isolation, fatigue, as well as stigma and shame.
Doctors in particular face unique barriers to seeking treatment and support for their mental health.
Medical Emergency, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Tuesday night at 8.
Now, Rose Ferriby is in Northumberland for On Your Farm.
I'm sitting down in a hay meadow, surrounded by the most wonderful cacophony of colour. There are buttercups and the seed pods of yellow rattle, all kinds of grasses swaying gently in the breeze, and butterflies are hither and thither. The hay meadow is just stretching out, and beyond I can see the rise of the Simonside Hills to the north, patches of woodland, and some of the follies here on the Wallington Estate in Northumberland, just near Morpeth. I've come to Gallows Hill Farm, about 5 minutes down the road from the house and gardens at Wallington. The farm here at Gallows Hill has gone through all kinds of changes since the 18th century, both in terms of its tenants, its farming practices, and I'm here today to find out about how these have changed in the more recent history.
Well, the only animals we've really got on the actual farmyard at the moment is the goats. So we've got the billy goats behind us, Bruno and Gary. And everything else is out, really.
I'm here with the newest tenants here at Gallows Hill Farm, Adam and Jenny Grieve. Now, Adam and Jenny won the tenancy of this farm, which is owned by the National Trust, after taking part in a TV competition. Part of their business plan involves receiving money from the government through stewardship schemes that support farming the land for nature, including reducing sheep numbers.
Ah,
little kids.
Yes.
When were these born?
We've got 5 kids. They were born end of February. There's also a nanny goat in here who shouldn't be here.
And Jenny, how long have you been here at the farm?
We've been here just over 3 years now. We're based on the Wallington Estate, so it's a National Trust property. We've got 340 acres where we've got sheep and cattle, and part of lots of different stewardship schemes which we work alongside Wallington and the National Trust with to develop the farm.
We can see the sheep and the goats, obviously, that we're standing next to. What else have you got on the farm, Adam?
Predominantly cattle, really, now. We've got Hereford cattle, we've got the Highlands, which just fit in, the both breeds fit in quite nicely with what we're trying to do alongside the stewardship with the trust. They respond quite well to the way we're farming them with a little input and trying to get maximum output, really.
The story of how you became tenants here is actually quite unusual, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the National Trust wanted to do something a bit different alongside Matt Baker and his production company about trying to show how difficult it was for young people to get a start and take on a farm tenancy. So we applied because of the location of the farm, really. I've grown up in this area my whole life, so know the area really well. And, you know, it was perfectly positioned, this farm, for us. So we had decided to go along with the process and apply, and we were the successful applicants.
And what are your jobs in the non-farming world?
So I work for the local authority. I work with an education, so I cover the whole of Northumberland. So it's a very busy, demanding day to then switch off, be a mum, and look after the farm.
What about you, Adam?
I'm a livestock auctioneer by trade, so working for Harrison Etherington, predominantly out in the Scottish Borders and North Northumberland. So having a farm's kind of just a sideline for me to keep my hand in when I'm working with other people's livestock, really.
These are 2 pet lambs. So these have been hand-reared by us and the boys. So they've only just come out in the field.
So what breeds have you got here on the farm in terms of sheep?
So we've got the Cheviots, which are a little bit further down, and then the Pure Suffolk here.
And obviously this traditionally is a very strong sheep farming area.
It's been predominantly sheep, plus a few cattle as well, but predominantly sheep that we've had over the years when I was growing up. So, you know, to come into a farm like this, which is renowned as a sheep farm, it was probably quite a good thing, really, because we could kind of get our stamp on it a little bit. But alongside the stewardship, we've probably started to find the balance a little bit more now.
So what's your stewardship agreement? Are you having to get your numbers down, or how's it working?
So the stewardship that we're in is predominantly cattle-based because of the way that they want the farm grazed. But we're working in quite nicely that we've got a sprinkling of sheep through that just keeps the sward lengths different, which fits in with the stewardship, really.
And how hard has it been trying to get a balance with the different numbers of stock?
I think the stewardship, although it has its benefits, does complicate it slightly because we can only use certain fields at certain time of the year. They can only be grazed for so long. We can only have certain animals on it. So there's certain fields where we can only put cattle, but we can't put sheep. So it is complicated, and I think it's been trial and error over the last 3 years. But I think we've seemed to this year have it working to what it's meant to be.
It must be hard to sort of gradually get used to that and just feel your way through each year.
Yeah, well, it's one of them, you know, coming to a farm. A lot of people say you'll only start to know the farm after 5 years, and then when you get to 10, you'll still realise you don't know the place. Because it does, you know, every year is different. You do start to understand what you can do and where. We feel like this year has been a turning point, really.
So this is what we're walking next to. That's one of the 6 hay meadows that we've got. So we have to take the sheep out by the 1st of May to let that grow, obviously, and then they'll be cut within the next couple of weeks. And
what percentage of the farm is that?
About 30% will be the hay meadows, I would say, roughly. So, I mean, it's, you know, the way that we do the hay meadows is no different to traditional methods. Just leave them a little bit longer till the grass and the seeds have all dropped. But it'd be hay made on here traditionally throughout the years. We just, it's some more sort of species rich fields we've got with different flowers and wild grasses and stuff coming through.
And do you let the cattle on there as well?
So yeah, once it's all cut and made into hay or haylage, depending on how we do it, the grass is allowed to
replenish,
yeah, I suppose is the right word. Let it get grown again, let it freshen up, and then we'll put some cattle on and some sheep on as well, just to spread thin, and they'll just slowly take the top off again and allow it to really get filled back up.
Get some nice sheep and cow poo on there.
Yes, exactly.
natural products.
Yeah.
So these are our Highland cattle. There's 4 calves in here at the moment, but they are half Highland cow, half Hereford cow. We do have a Highland bull, so we bought him this year.
Is he down with the very curly hair?
With the straight horns out.
Oh, yeah. Horn giving us a look.
Yes.
How would this farm have been traditionally farmed, Adam? And what's changed most, do you think?
Traditionally, it would have been farmed a lot more intensively. The numbers of sheep would be significantly higher, and cattle as well. You know, they do complement each other, sheep and cattle. But like on a farm like this and where it is, you'd probably be looking at sort of 600, 700, 800 yows, possibly more. So it would have been far more intensively farmed than what we have it, but then you'd have a lot more inputs into it as well. So it depends on how you're trying to manage it, really. But because we both work full-time, we try and farm it in a much lower scale and much easier scale for ourselves, really, so the numbers aren't just as high, but we get as much out of the ground as we can to support the animals we have.
So your sort of working lives is a nice balance with what the National Trust are trying to achieve with their goals for nature, I suppose.
Yeah, I think definitely that's probably why we're fitting so well. We farm it to what we can manage, and that fits in with the National Trust vision for a little bit more lower scale, lower input that gets more out for the environment and the wildlife around us.
And what do you think the biggest challenges are in terms of trying to farm in this way? What have you found the most difficult?
It's mostly to do with the grazing for the livestock we've got. You know, managing the grazing of the livestock throughout the farm, depending on the year you've got and the different time of the year. That's probably the biggest challenge we have, but that's, you know, something that we're learning with and getting on top of every year.
If you weren't working both full-time as well, you wouldn't be able to make a living from the farm as it is now.
Not unless it was farmed more intensively, which that isn't the plan for here. So, you know, we both work full-time and we'll continue to do that.
Well, it's a good model, isn't it, to be able to look at in terms of what actually can be produced on a farm at this scale and in this way. And it's an interesting thing for other people to see.
I've grown up where farming's always been more intensively, and people see a farm and think you've got to get the most out of it. But there is a little bit to be said for, yes, getting what you need out of it, but also making sure that the farm is getting what it needs and progressing, and, you know, nature as well. Everything's relative. And I think it's about getting the balance and making sure that not just you're thriving, but everything's thriving around you.
This is the yellow rattle. You can hear that, you know, known as hay rattle. And these are all the seed pods just about to kind of burst and release the seed. And that's obviously why we're asking Adam and Jenny to hold off with the haymaking for this particular plant to set seed,
I'm here with Paul Hewitt, who's the countryside manager for the National Trust's Wallington Estate. It's a beautiful estate. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, we're kind of about 20 miles from Newcastle, sort of 13, 14 from Morpeth. The Trust have had it since the 1940s, but it's actually one of the largest agricultural estates that the Trust manages, with sort of 13 farms across it. So this farm is around the 130 hectare mark.
And as we look out on the landscape today, Paul, we're in front of this beautiful hay meadow, and beyond us we can see the hills just rising up, patches of woodland. Has this landscape changed a lot in the last 50 or so years?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue it's probably changed an awful lot in the last 300, actually, because it's gone through successional changes. I mean, originally it would have been sort of maybe kind of much more, you know, low-grade farming, quite sort of wet agriculturally. And basically within the 18th century there was lots of work was done by Sir Walter Blackett, who basically drained and laid out the estate we see today with the farms and the hedgerow system. And then that largely stayed intact really through the generations of the family that had it, and then came to the Trevelyans, and then still see a network of hedgerows, and we'll continue to work in with the farm tenants on putting those back.
And all this work, Paul, this is part of the Wilder Wallington plan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, the National Trust has been on a journey over the last 10 years to do its bit towards the climate and nature crisis that we're in. We're looking to, you know, restore nature. And on Wallington, tenants have done a great job of managing the land over the last 50, 60 years, but potentially we can still have more.
So how's the Wilder Wallington project working with the tenant farmers here on the estate, Paul?
Well, obviously very closely, because most of the estate is tenanted. So it's kind of been a journey trying to understand what the requirements are of our particular, you know, our farmers that are here at the minute, and working with them and trying to weave our way through the change in all the various systems and the grant systems. So on this particular farm here, we were able to get, before Madden and Jenny moved in, we were able to get funding for re-wetting of the fell here, which involved re-zipping up the drainage ditches to allow it to be much wetter. And then as a result of that, Adam and Jenny have been able to get in a scheme, which is basically getting paid for public goods, so basically for storing water in a flood event on permanent grasslands and managing it with cattle. And so it's kind of this connectivity, this way of it sort of all joining up nicely from that. This particular farm here, when it came up and the previous tenants retired, this is where we were able to sort of really maybe think about the direction of travel. We felt as if it was going to be better suited to more of a nature-friendly farming system, so, you know, far fewer sheep numbers and maybe a few more cows to manage with hay meadows and the wetlands area. And then we've actually, this is where our beavers are as well at the bottom here, so, you know, there's a bit of an epicentre for nature recovery.
What was the farm like before the new tenants came in, Paul?
It, you know, been managed very successfully as a very productive sheep farm for 30 years by the previous tenant. Because of the level of grazing, we wouldn't have seen long grass like this. So Adam and Jenny have now gone over to a more of a balanced system, more of a challenging system in many ways, because, you know, this field is effectively sitting there doing nothing now with no animals in while the wildflowers set seed.
What do you think the challenges are for trying to work in this way, trying to get the right balance between productivity and nature-friendly farming?
Well, it is hugely challenging. I mean, because it, at the end of the day, it does come down to economics, and, you know, how can you afford to do this when you're lowering your stocking levels? So on this particular scheme, that it is the environmental land management payments which are basically boosting that payment for losses.
And this is obviously quite a new way of doing things here at Wallington, with the way you're doing the grazing, but also having the beavers here and things. What do the other farmers and people locally think about it?
Probably have to ask them that. It'd be really interesting to know, wouldn't it? But I think what we're trying to demonstrate here is that you can be done. We really do believe that we can produce good quality food, but not at the expense of the environment. For me, the whole nature ethos of this is that the end product being the livestock is one thing, but actually the soil restoration, using the farm as a giant sponge to kind of hold water in these extreme weather events. So the potential of this is therefore to be doing so much more than just producing food. It's also the public benefit. And I do kind of think that this is, in Northumberland, this is effectively a form of diversification, you know, for nature and for nature systems, the nature-based solutions, to be the diversification that our tenants can do here.
Well, it's great to be able to test these things at different farms and try things out, and for everyone to be able to share that information and move on together to try and find different ways of farming and moving into a slightly uncertain future.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to be doing this with every single farm, but when a new farm comes up for tenancy, we are looking at how we can look at those main reasons of food production, but all the other add-ons as well.
And obviously Jenny and Adam have been here for 3 years now, Paul, but the story of how you got them in here as tenants is actually quite an interesting one, isn't it, with the television programme. Can you tell us how you came up with it?
It was quite an interesting process. It was just something different. I think we were approached by Matt Baker and his team that were very keen on doing a programme about tenant farming and how you'd get a farm in the first instance. So obviously Adam and Jenny kind of came out in the end, awarded the farm for their business plan. I think Gallows Hill's a really good example, Rose, of where we've tried to, with the new tenancy, just ask for outcomes rather than dictating how they get there. When we put the tenancy out, we described how we would like to see the land looking in sort of 20, 30 years' time. And left it very much to the individuals that then applied for the tenancy to see how they could manage their farm business to kind of work with those outcomes.
And it must be really interesting having a sense of the past tenancies of this farm.
Within the archives, there's written conversations between Charles Phillips Trevelyan and his tenants in the 1930s when they were going out for their rent reviews and stuff. There's a whole tenancy history bit of tenant farming on Wallington.
Well, it's fantastic to have that depth of knowledge, isn't it, about a farm and the different kinds of things that people have observed and learnt from it over time. And I think that's the lovely thing about farms, that these holding posts for people and stories, but also a really deep knowledge of the land. Thinking of that idea of how knowledge stays in places, I've now come up back to the farmyard and I've come to meet Dick Thompson, who actually grew up here on the farm, didn't you, Dick?
I did, yes. My father was the tenant here from 1961 to 1991, so I'd be six when I came here. It's very interesting to be standing in the farmyard looking at all the old buildings.
How much as a whole has the farm up here changed since you were here?
Probably very little. Looking around, there's not a lot of change apart from more concrete, a nice set of handling stocks that have spoilt my old football and tennis pitch. One of my earliest memories was playing tennis with father and mother and my older sister, but we only had three tennis rackets and mother had to play with the kitchen shovel.
Did she ever win?
I don't think so, no.
And when you were growing up here, was it predominantly a sheep farm or mixed?
Very much mixed stock. We had 52 cows and a bull and 350 sheep. So I think that's a lot higher density than there is now. But most of the cattle lived outdoors. The one little shed had a 10 maybe in over winter. The sheep would be either Scottish black-faced or mules.
You've been working most of your life as a vet.
Yeah.
Were you inspired by growing up here on the farm?
Yes, very much so.
And has your interest in animals brought you back here, I understand, to work with the beavers at the bottom of the field?
That's right, yes. I'm very interested in the beavers. The National Trust asked me a couple of years ago what my father would have thought of the beavers. And I'm very convinced he would have been quite happy with it. The area that the beavers are in is a natural valley. It's minimal grazing. And he would have been tickled pink with beavers, yes.
Do you think we could go and have a look at them?
We could do, yes. Yeah. It's only about a quarter of an hour's walk away, so...
Yes. Oh, my goodness, that'll keep me fit.
OK.
Well, Dick and I have just come down through the fields, and we've come down to a little gentle valley with a winding, very browny-coloured brook running below, surrounded on one side by trees and woodland, and on this side, where Dick and I are standing, with beautiful grassland. And this is lovely, isn't it, Dick? We're surrounded by butterflies and crickets, and it's a wonderful spot.
It certainly is. It's my favourite spot on the farm. I've been coming down here for 65 years, or it's 65 years since I first came down. And some things have changed and some things haven't. The brook that I've been talking about, at this time of year the stream would be almost negligible. Probably wouldn't be able to see any of it at all from here. But now I can see 50 yards of 4 metre wide river, which is the pools behind some of the dams.
And this is the beaver dams.
The beaver dams, yes. There's six beaver dams all together and a lodge. And there's a tributary going up through the wood that has another two dams in it. And I think there's 8 beavers in there at the moment. So.
And we can actually see the one of the dams from where we're standing, can't we, with the big pool behind it.
We can see the pool, and the lodge is the pile of wood at the end of it. So, yes, very good. And from this spot, last summer I saw a beaver on that riverbank over there. But you have to come fairly late at night to get that.
And this is where you used to come to do your thinking, isn't
thinking,
it?
Thinking, yes. Yes. It's a real pleasure to be back here today.
It's nice that you can come back and be involved in the work with the beavers as well and get to stand thinking here once again.
Yes, I'm part of the beaver fence inspection team.
And aside from the stream and the beavers, can you see a difference in what you're seeing down here?
It's rather a difficult one for me because somehow nature and environmental thoughts weren't thought of as particularly important. So I come down here and think this was paradise, but didn't do any measuring, recording, anything else. While we've been standing here for 10 minutes, I've seen 6 different butterflies. I wouldn't have known 6 different butterflies in those days to recognise. So I've learned an awful lot, particularly in the last few years, about environmental things and the beavers and the insects and things. So it's a real eye-opener for me. But as far as the farm went in those days, it wasn't really a consideration. We didn't pull fences out, we didn't pull hedges out, but we didn't do anything terribly positive in that way. And I think this is great. I'm a real enthusiast of this Beaver Valley because it's perfect countryside. It's not going to spoil anything and it's adding something to the environment. I'm a great fan.
Does it give you hope for the future in this wonderful place?
Yes, very much so. Yes, I think, you know, my little paradise is now preserved. It's wonderful.
Long may it be so.
Yes, that's right. I'll come back in another 65 years and find out.
And Dick, how does it make you feel seeing the changes on this farm?
Well, standing where we are in my paradise spot, really pleased with it. The Beaver Valley, the beavers seem to be doing world of good, and there's so many more flowers and everything about. And I'm very much for nature has to have a place on a farm, but agriculture needs a place on the farm as well, and there has to be enough grazing, say, to keep a farmer. Now, agriculture and nature must find a balance. They must learn to live with each other.
This morning's On Your Farm came from Northumberland and was presented and produced by Rose Ferriby. And next week, On Your Farm visits a vet with a passion for dung beetles who's taken on a farm in Wales. That's at 6:35 next Sunday morning. There's been some welcome rain on many a farm in recent days. And with a look ahead to today's prospects now, here's Stabden Hills.
Thanks very much, John. Yes, indeed. And there is more rain on the cards as we move through the rest of this weekend and indeed for the first week of September, as lower pressure will tend to dominate the weather. But there is signs of it turning a little bit drier across southern parts of the UK as high pressure re-establishes itself over the near continent. But for this morning, it's quite a mixed bag. We've got some clear skies with some sunshine through Wales, parts of the South Midlands and into southern England. It's here where we've seen some early mist and fog patches. Elsewhere, cloudier skies with showers, even longer spells of rain, especially across Scotland, with some heavy, maybe even thundery rain pushing through the Lothians and the Edinburgh area as I speak. Now, for the rest of today, for England, showers will begin to turn more widespread as we head through the latter part of the morning into the afternoon. Some of them will turn out to be heavy and thundery, much like the last few days. But the southeast corner of England is likely to escape most of the showers. Certainly early on, they will begin to trundle their way in later in the day. And again, there could be the odd heavier one. Temperatures across England, we're looking at around 90 to 22 degrees. But in the southeast, given more in the way of sunshine and fewer showers, we could be up to around 23 or 24 degrees. For Wales, it's going to be a cloudier day with heavy occasional thundery showers developing. There will be some brighter, sunnier moments in between. Temperatures 19 to 22 degrees. Northern Ireland, limited sunshine for you as well. There'll be heavy, possibly thundery showers developing, pushing their way eastwards. Temperatures 16 to 19 Celsius. Scotland, quite a mixed bag for you. A lot of cloud around with showers or longer spells of rain. Some heavy for early on. And then into the afternoon, it looks like we'll begin to see sunshine and showers. Temperatures 16 to 19 degrees, but cooler than that across the Northern Isles. Now, winds today are likely to strengthen across England and Wales from the southwest, gusting up to 40 miles an hour across more exposed coastal areas of Devon and Cornwall. Tonight, the showers will continue for a while. They will rattle on through the night. 10 to 14 degrees. Tomorrow, it looks like we'll start with showers, but then it should turn a bit sunnier through the afternoon.
Thanks, Staff. After the news and a look at the morning papers, it'll be time for Sunday. Our look at the ethical and religious issues of the week, presented by Emily Buchanan. A little later this morning, it'll be time for Sunday worship. And throughout the next few months, we'll be featuring four special programmes exploring pathways and pilgrimage routes along the coastlines of the United Kingdom. The first in this series comes from Northern Ireland and takes us to Strangford Loch in County Down and the ancient monastic site of Nendrum. That's in Sunday worship, which begins, as usual, at 10 past 8 here on BBC Radio 4.
On BBC iPlayer.
There is a problem. A British contractor was shot in Svalbard up in the Arctic Circle.
Put down the gun!
This is DCI Silver.
I know who she is.
We have to keep things contained.
They go to war over this.
This is not the fight you can win.
The Russians are here, and it looks like they've come mob-handed.
Let's all stay calm. Okay, no one needs to get hurt. We need backup.
Amy, no!
The new series of Vigil. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 30th of August. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Prisoners convicted of manslaughter, including the killers of PC Andrew Harper, have been blocked from the government's early release scheme. Wednesday's flash floods in Nepal are now known to have killed more than 700 people as efforts continue to rescue workers trapped in tunnels. And NASA is launching a new telescope into space in an effort to expand the search for planets beyond our solar system. The Prime Minister has told the BBC that anyone convicted of an unlawful killing, which includes all forms of manslaughter, will be exempt from the prison early release scheme in England and Wales. In an exclusive interview with BBC Breakfast, Andy Burnham said the changes would keep hundreds of people behind bars, including the killers of PC Andrew Harper. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
Andy Burnham faced his toughest political test yet when it emerged that two of PC Andrew Harper's killers would be eligible for early release. The Prime Minister had already expanded the list of those not eligible to include some rapists and child sex offenders. He had suggested he couldn't go any further, but under pressure from victims' families changed his mind. He told BBC Breakfast that hundreds more people would now stay behind bars.
Not just those guilty of manslaughter, but those convicted for indecent assault, for death by dangerous driving, all of these offenders now will remain in prison.
The Justice Secretary is expected to give a more precise number of prisoners affected when he updates MPs in Parliament on Tuesday. Mr. Burnham said he would free up space on the prison estate by deporting foreign criminals and releasing people on controversial indefinite sentences handed out in previous decades under public protection rules. But those measures will not create extra space for some time, meaning adult male prisons, currently operating at around 98% capacity, could get even busier.
More than 730 people are now known to have died in Nepal after Wednesday's devastating flash floods. Officials say around 2,500 people are still missing and rescue teams are warning that search efforts are being hampered by the rain. Nepali army rescuers are engaged in a desperate bid to save dozens of workers who are thought to be trapped inside tunnels at a hydroelectric plant. Our South Asia correspondent, Azadeh Mashiri, reports from Kathmandu.
The forecast suggests the rain will continue until at least tomorrow, adding to an already challenging search and rescue operation. Many remain trapped in hydropower tunnels in northern Nepal, and thick mud is blocking rescuers from entering them. India and China have both sent experts to help. With hundreds of foreign nationals missing, aid is continuing to pour in. The United States has pledged $3.6 million in humanitarian assistance, while the United Kingdom has sent a rapid deployment team to Nepal to support British nationals. This is Nepal's worst disaster in more than a decade. Scientists believe the flash flood was triggered by a glacial collapse when all or part of a glacier disintegrates and led to catastrophic impacts downstream.
Across the border in Tibet, Chinese state media say that 16 people have been confirmed dead. More than 500 others are still missing. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
Chinese state media reported that among the 546 people missing after Wednesday's landslide, 261 are foreigners from 23 countries, including 15 British nationals. Rescue teams searching through mud and debris at the Tibetan border, the main crossing point for tourists heading from Kathmandu to the sacred Mount Kailash, have so far found no survivors. State media said teams have had to be moved to safety after yet another landslide in the area. It was spotted by a drone and it appears to have formed another lake among the debris downstream from an existing body of water that has been a concern for days. The report says experts are currently assessing the risk it may pose.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has condemned violence by settlers in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military said soldiers and border police responded to reports of Israeli rioters in the northern village of Kusra, throwing stones at Palestinians. Mr. Netanyahu said they were harming the country's standing in the world. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Katie Watson, reports.
There's been unified condemnation of the violence in the occupied West Bank, rare criticism that was prompted after dozens of settlers attacked the village of Kusra before the military was called to remove them. Foreign journalists were also injured by masked settlers in an attack in the town of Jalud. Benjamin Netanyahu called the settlers a handful of rioters who are violating the law. The president, Isaac Herzog, said it was a stain on the face of Israel. The number of Israeli settlements and outposts has escalated in recent years, most notably since Hamas attacked Israel in October 2023. All settlements are illegal under international law. Outposts are also illegal under Israeli law, though they're often supported by state services and funding.
Rescue teams have been working throughout the night after a vessel with five people on board was reported to be in distress off the coast of Plymouth. A helicopter, a plane and lifeboats were involved in the operation in the channel. NASA is due to launch a new telescope later, which the space agency says will help it study distant planets in more than a billion galaxies. The first images from the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope are expected early next year. The astrophysicist Eamon Kerins from Manchester University will be at the launch at Cape Canaveral for the European Space Agency. He says the telescope will also tell us more about our own galaxy.
Each image it takes would require 36 ultra-high definition screens to show in full detail. So a really quite amazing instrument. It will allow us to build a big three-dimensional picture of our galaxy, unlike we've ever been able to do before.
And the British boxer Moses Itama has failed in his attempt to become the youngest heavyweight world champion since Mike Tyson in 1986. The 21-year-old was beaten by Croatia's Filip Hrgović in their IBF title in London. Our boxing reporter, Adi Adidoyan, watched the bout.
Moses Itama was hoping to become Britain's youngest ever heavyweight world champion, but it was Filip Hrgović who wrote his name in the history books. The 34-year-old produced a remarkable comeback to stop an exhausted Itama in the ninth round of a grueling contest to become Croatia's first heavyweight champion of the world. The 21-year-old Itama dominated the early exchanges and knocked Hrgović down in the second round, but the Croatian showed great resilience and weathered the storm. He piled on the pressure as Itama tired in the ninth, forcing the referee to stop the fight. Heartbreak for Itama, who suffered the first loss of his career. For Hrgović, a landmark moment for him and his country.
Well, that's the news this morning. Now we'll take a look at the Sunday papers. And the Sunday Telegraph says the Chancellor, John Healey, is mulling a windfall tax on banks and oil companies in the budget. Treasury officials are said to be looking at ways of plugging a £4.7 billion black hole without raising direct taxes on individuals. The paper suggests banks and oil companies are seen as low-hanging fruit. BP is said to have more than doubled its profits between April and June because of higher oil prices caused by the Iran war. In its editorial, the paper warns against the windfall tax move, saying it will harm growth by denting investor confidence. According to the Mail on Sunday, Russia is poised to target Britain with a cyber attack on a drone or missile factory. A key adviser to President Putin, the former Deputy Foreign Minister Andrei Fedorov, tells the paper the highest levels of the Russian government are considering such a strike. A drone factory owned by the British-Ukrainian firm Yukospec Systems is said to be the target. Its location near RAF Mildenhall in Suffolk was made public in April. The Sunday Times reports that Andy Burnham has given what it calls a lucrative pay rise to train drivers on the Avanti London to Manchester line. The deal with union leaders was said to have been made to avoid strikes on a flagship service and one of the busiest lines in Europe. The paper suggests industrial action would have proved embarrassing for cabinet ministers travelling to the Prime Minister's new political hub, No. 10 North, in Manchester. According to both the Sunday Telegraph and the Sunday People, new studies suggest that statins can reduce the risk of dementia, as well as lowering cholesterol and the risk of heart attacks. The Telegraph reports that the largest study by Denmark's Copenhagen University Hospital found that the daily pills reduce the chances of dementia by up to 15%. The paper says the research means statins could benefit around 6 million of almost 10 million people aged 70 and over in the UK who are not currently taking them. The Sunday Mirror reports that Peter Homer, the ex-boss of Nottingham NHS Trust, where a review found that 520 mothers or babies suffered potentially avoidable death or harm, is now CEO of a firm giving maternity training to the health service. Grieving families tell the paper that they are concerned by the news. Mr. Homer was approached for comment. And The Sun on Sunday suggests the X Factor could return 7 years after it left our screens. ITV chiefs are said to be in talks about revamping the programme for a younger generation. And that's our look at today's Sunday papers.
Read by Charles Carroll. This is BBC Radio 4. Now it's time for Sunday with Emily Buchanan.
Welcome to Sunday. A new BBC investigation of police data shows that religious hate crime is rising faster than any other form of hate crime. We explore what the results mean, both for anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. The minimalist composer Steve Reich turns 90, and he tells us why the Bible is still the inspiration for his musical works.
Biblical reality turns out to be very much a present reality. If that weren't the case in Scripture, then people wouldn't find it constantly interesting as it is.
And how Dolly Parton became an unlikely icon for young gay Christians in America.
Dolly herself, her Christianity is much bigger than the kind of white Christian nationalism that often characterizes contemporary American evangelicalism.
Do send your comments to sunday@bbc.co.uk. First, Nepal. The huge torrent of rock, ice, mud and debris, which hurtled through mountain river systems on Wednesday, continues to wreak havoc. The death toll in Nepal has risen to 734, according to the country's Disaster Management Agency. Rescue teams are warning that search efforts are being hampered by the rain. Our South Asia correspondent, Azadeh Mashiri, reports from Kathmandu.
An agonising search for answers. On a mortuary wall, pictures of the bodies that have been recovered. Men, women, infants. The injuries so graphic, some of the faces are unrecognisable. Small cries beneath the rubble. Amid the devastation, hope still surfaces. Child, don't be scared, the rescuers say. For days, Manisha has been lying here. She is now recovering in hospital, according to the police. Manisha is just one of the thousands who've been saved. While emergency operations continue, Nepal is on high alert, wary of more flooding and grappling with the chaos of the aftermath.
Well, aid is arriving, but it's proving difficult to reach the people affected. Krishna Adhikari is from the Christian NGO International Nepal Fellowship. They have volunteers working in Nuwakot, one of the affected districts. Krishna, tell me, how are your volunteers managing to get aid in?
First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to be interviewed here today. And our team, we sent the first team on Thursday on the motorbike, and they had to carry their motorbike for sometimes because of the lack of the road access, all these things, and they had to leave the motorbike somewhere and they had to walk, and they had no internet connection, no phone connection, all these things. But they really worked hard, and they are now there in that place where around 1,500 people are sheltering in some of the schools in the municipality. It's called Bidur municipalities. And yesterday, from the day before yesterday, our team worked overnight, and we prepared three trucks of essential items. That includes food items, hygiene kits, women and children, and also water bottle, and some of those essential items like mosquito net, all these things. And our team arrived just this morning, 1 hour ago. I was in contact with them, and they have started giving, handing those materials to them.
Right, so they're managing to get quantities of aid. I mean, obviously, just carrying by hand, if they've had to carry their motorbikes, there's not much aid they can bring in, is there?
No, but they took the alternative route. And that took longer than it would be. So some of the road access is beginning, though some of this are already starting to destroyed by the rainfall. So they took a longer route to there. So
okay. What's the role of the local churches? Are they becoming places where people are sheltering?
Yeah, I heard that one of the churches, they are sheltering some of the people there. And we had a contact with one of the pastors from the Roswell this morning also. And he there trying to help people there, but he himself and so many church leaders and pastors are missing and, you know, have found dead.
Yes, presumably a lot of the churches have been swept away.
Yeah, and in our context, we are working with Pokhara Christian Communities and another organization, Asal Chimeki Nepal, Good Neighborhood. So the church volunteers came and did all the volunteering work, packing and loading the things. And they're with us. So they are already trained for these sort of things. Like we have learned from 2015 earthquake also, but a large number of volunteers from the church, Pokhara Christian Community and other church, they are taking part.
Right. So back in 2015, when there was an earthquake, that was the sort of scenes that your volunteers are meeting now is similar.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are they telling you, though, about the kind of scenes they're finding and the state that people are in?
Yeah, it's very devastating. We can feel that, and the need as they go, and the more need is there. So the immediate need coming is on the health side. You know, people living with sugar or pressure, they don't have the medicines, and all this because of the death, all these things are, you know, making worse. So we have prepared our medical team who will be leaving this afternoon. Nurses, doctors, and some counselor will be leaving this afternoon. At the same time, our team on the ground, they do more assessment and they will let us know. Or another team is working here.
And just briefly, are you finding many people in the UK are wanting to help and donate to this effort?
Yeah. Yeah. So many people we have been approached, and we are very thankful to grateful to the people in the UK. From INS Inspiration, it is a great legacy and partnership there. And we are feel very supportive from the people in the UK, and we thank for that.
Great. Thank you very much, Krishna Adhikari. And we wish your volunteers every strength in their efforts. Last week on Sunday, we looked at the problem of churches lying empty and spoke to Simon Jenkins about his big idea of adopting a European-style church tax to fund them being handed back to the community. This week, we're headed to Scotland, where the issue of church closures is severe. Over 400 have shut since 2020. There is some good news. One community has taken ownership of Brechin Cathedral. This 800-year-old landmark stopped being a regular place of worship in November 2021 after the congregation just became too small. So is this the way to save religious sites from closure? Well, I'm joined by the Reverend Dr. Scott Rennie, who chairs the General Trustees of Church of Scotland and is a former minister of Brechin Cathedral. Morning, Dr. Rennie. What problems was Brechin Cathedral facing?
Well, essentially, it's a very ancient, it's a complex building. I mean, it's a real jewel, actually. But the problem is these buildings are difficult to look after, and even more so if there is no congregation anymore to look after them.
So what happens then? They just, I mean, this cathedral closed, didn't it? So it's just been sitting there empty.
Yes. So a local friends group took on management of it for the church and did a great job. But it wasn't going to be a long-term solution, really. We needed something, a more robust group with deeper roots in the community to take on the building.
And what was the reaction when people began to see that, you know, it could just stay closed for a long time? I mean, Is it a building that's really valued in the community? What does it look like? Can you just give us a sense of that?
Yes, I mean it's a medieval church that has been restored by the Victorians to its proportions. It's a beautiful building. It's got one of the best collections of stained glass in Scotland. It's got Pictish stones in it. I mean, it's really a building that speaks of its roots. It has one of only two round towers in Scotland adjoining it. So it's a wonderful old church. It's beautiful. But, you know, complex building to look after, very expensive. But I think there was a huge amount of anxiety in the community about what its future would be.
So there was even people who don't go to church. People wanted to preserve it somehow.
Absolutely. And not only preserve it, but to keep it as a living building, including a building that worship can continue in from time to time, be that for rites of passage or be it for hides and holidays, I suppose. So, but the group, the trust who took it on are doing a great job of programming events for the local community in that building, and I think it's a great example of what can be done. And I think it touches on this core issue of church buildings being valued by their wider communities, but then how can those wider communities bring resources to the building so that they can have a good and prosperous future?
Well, talking of resources, I mean, last week we talked about the idea of a church tax, as happens in other European countries. Do you think, well, I wondered how this, the idea of a community trust, how does that compare with some sort of church tax that would be a voluntary tax, but which would just provide the sort of funding that you're talking about?
So community trusts work when they have the buy-in of their communities. But again, it depends on a very dedicated group of volunteers with the passion to look after a building and then to try and raise money, essentially, either through programming or through other means in their wider community. But I think we do have in the United Kingdom, Scotland including, a structural issue about historic ecclesiastical buildings. All the time, you mentioned earlier the number of closures that have been in Scotland, and to some extent that was unavoidable because simply the church and congregations are smaller. We don't have the money to keep all these buildings. The trouble is in communities, people feel they're not just a church building, as important as that is. They feel they're also a wider community resource. But then if they, and I think they are, but the problem is one has to find a way to get that wider resource to look after them. I mean, you simply can't ask a small group of people to do the job. And I think politicians in the UK have to start having a conversation about whether something like a voluntary tax or some levy or some means can be found to hypothecate money for ecclesiastical buildings. I mean, in some towns and villages, the post office is gone, the pub's gone, the school's gone, and the church might be the only thing left. And so, really, we have to find a way.
Yes, because what you're saying is that a community trust is all very well, but how do you sustain it, where something like a church tax would be ongoing, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And also, it's going to be much easier to create community trusts or community management of church buildings, say, as long if people know there is going to be a pool of resource to help them. And that's what I think we as a country have not come to terms with. We've got to find a revenue stream.
Okay. Thank you so much, the Reverend Dr. Scott Rennie. Organisers of a Christian festival in Sussex say they're devastated after a sign fell at their event, with one man dying at the scene and seven others injured. The big church festival was immediately cancelled. I spoke earlier to the BBC's Simon Jones, who's been speaking to festival goers.
Well, this was Friday afternoon and the festival at that time was in full swing. People had been coming together for music, prayer, for podcasts and worship, but a big wooden sign fell down, injuring several people. Now, the man who died was 41 years old from Eastbourne, so from the local area. Now, Festival goers have told us it was windy on Friday, so that may explain why the sign came down. Now, one person who was there, Judah Martin from Kent, said he saw vehicles speeding towards the area where the incident happened before all the campers were told to return to their tents immediately. He said the phone signal isn't very good in that area, so people were struggling for information, struggling to understand what had happened. Another person who was at the festival, Jessica Schaffenhauer, had travelled from Leipzig in Germany for the event, and she said afterwards, once people realised what had happened, they were united, they sang together, they prayed together. But another eyewitness said everyone was pretty bewildered and a little dazed trying to really take in what had happened.
And this is a big festival, isn't it? Tell us more about the actual event.
The Big Church Festival describes itself as the UK's biggest Christian festival. It was founded back in 2009, and on the website it describes it as a joy and unity, love and celebration. And the organisers, though, say, in a way, that turned to devastation on Friday. The organisers said they've been working with the emergency services, police and the health and safety executive as they establish the circumstances surrounding exactly what happened. And really, there's been reflection within the community and further afield. We've had the Archbishop of Canterbury saying she was sad and shocked to hear about the fatal incident. Dame Sarah Mullally said, "I pray for the man who died's family, friends and loved ones as they grieve. I pray for those receiving treatment and the healthcare workers looking after them." And she also says she prays for the other festival goers, staff and event organisers as they come to terms with the tragic events.
And as you mentioned, one man very sadly died. What about the others who were injured? Do we know anything about them?
Well, we know that two were described as having serious injuries. Some were taken to hospital. And pretty shortly after it happened, the festival organisers decided they would call off the rest of the event. It was due to run from Friday until Sunday. They decided it wasn't right to carry on. So then a lot of people were wondering what best to do. And actually, a Salvation Army in Hove opened its hall on Friday to allow people to stay the night if they couldn't get home after the event was cancelled. And they said they welcomed about 20 people from Bristol and the northwest of England. Others spent the Friday night at the campsite and then on Saturday were leaving the site. We spoke to some of them as they were departing, and the view was it was the right thing for this festival to be called off. But you really got a sense of the shock amongst the people who had been there and the bewilderment about what had happened.
And there is still a mystery, actually, as to how this actually happened.
Well, there's going to be a full investigation, no doubt, that will involve the police and the health and safety executive, because there were hundreds of people at that festival. As I said before, it was windy, but they will want to know how exactly this sign came down, what sort of mitigations potentially were in place to try to prevent something like this from happening. So a lot of questions, but many in the community saying it is a time to unite, a time to come together, to think about the family of the man who died and to think about those who were injured and just those who were there, who may have witnessed what have happened or were simply at the festival learning about what happened afterwards, but who found it a very worrying and pretty traumatic event.
Simon Jones. This Wednesday, the BBC Prom celebrates the 90th birthday of an icon in contemporary music, Steve Reich. He pioneered the minimalist style and he's an artist whose Jewish faith and heritage is central to his work. The Proms will stage a performance of his monumental 1981 work, Telehim, which is a setting of the Hebrew translation of Psalm 19. Reich experienced a profound Jewish reawakening during the mid-1970s, but it turns out faith has always had an impact on his music, going right back to his seminal 1964 work, It's Gonna Rain.
In the middle 60s, myself and many other composers were fooling around with tape loops. That's recording tape, which most people who are listening to will say, what's that? So you could literally take the tape and put it in a splicing block and splice the beginning to the end, and you have a loop, which you can put in a tape recorder, press the go button, and it'll repeat over and over again. And what happens when you do that with recorded speech is that you hear the voice, melody, voice, melody, voice, melody. So when it comes to speech melody, a black Pentecostal preacher that I recorded, or any most black Pentecostal preachers have unbelievably melodic voices. Their sermons, or when they're delivering their text, hovers between singing and speaking.
Can you just describe it?
This was Brother Walter, who that was the only name I know him by. He seemed to be in his late 20s or early 30s. When I went back a week later, he was gone, and I don't know where on earth he is. That was 1965. I don't know if he's alive or dead. But I have these recordings, and sure enough, if you listen to It's Gonna Rain, you hear it. It's gonna rain, What is It's Gonna Rain? It comes from the flood of Noah's time. He's delivering a flood. Now, he was delivering this in Union Square to anyone who would listen. 2 years previous, we had what was called at the time the Cuban Missile Crisis. So when I hear this guy, this preacher, preaching incredibly forcefully and charismatically about Noah and the flood and the end of the world, I think, right on. You know, the Bible foretells all possibilities, and the Bible was right there being realized in 1963, and happily, this was resolved. Also, tensions for nuclear destruction hover over your head and my head today. That's the whole background to the piece, where a biblical reality turns out to be very much a present reality. If that weren't the case in Scripture, then people wouldn't find it constantly interesting as it is.
So it's very exciting. You're bringing Tehillim to the proms. I was very interested in Tehillim. How did the idea come to you?
Somewhere around 1980, when I wrote Tehillim, I had become more involved in my Judaic background and learning a little Hebrew, because I knew nothing about it. I mean, I knew I was Jewish, but no information, no familiarity with text. So two things. First of all, in Western music, you had to pick the most commonly said text. I think the Psalms would win hands down from the 12th century to now when you and I are speaking. So I literally started reading the Book of Psalms in English with a facing page in Hebrew, and I picked out certain parts of Psalms that I thought, now this I believe in, and this I'd like to set. So I chose the beginning one is from Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God in Hebrew, Hashemayim Masaparim Kavod Kel. And if you want to set words to music, if you deal with the words first, then they will help you generate the music. And sure enough, as I went around the house, suddenly I was doing, and then I thought to myself, and then I started singing, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
Have you found that your interest in spirituality, that has driven the way you've written some of your music?
Absolutely. I'm able to use mostly Hebrew text, sometimes translations of biblical texts. And it's interesting, all the religious music that we think of in the West comes out of Christianity, comes out of Gregorian chant moves forward. There is Hebrew chant as well, but the religious law within traditional Judaism, not Reform Judaism, but just traditional Orthodox Judaism, it forbids the use of decorative melodies. In other words, there is a fixed way to chant the scriptures, which is wonderful, which is fine. I respect that. But as a composer, I want to set the music as I hear it. And in doing that, the music is no longer liturgical, i.e. no one would play Tehillim in a synagogue. And if they did, it would be probably a, quote, Reform synagogue, and they would be giving concerts regularly, and that's fine, you know. So basically, I realized if I'm going to set Hebrew texts to music, which I want to do as an expression of my belief in those texts and the interest in those texts, that's going to be concert music, and it will live or die, and the quality of the music.
Well, I certainly think your energy and your creativity at 90 are quite extraordinary. Thank you so much. And I just wondered whether your faith and your creativity actually helps lead a good and long life.
Well, I mean, look, I can say from the first person, it has been of a benefit to me. I can be short-tempered and annoying and a pain in the you-know-what. And I'm a little bit less so. So I can say, thank God you didn't get rid of all of it. But if you got even a little bit, thank you. And my wife and many others, thank you as well.
Steve Reich, and you can hear his prom at 10:15 p.m. on Wednesday on Radio 3. The time is just after 7:30. Later, we return to Nepal and talk to an anthropologist about the religious geography of the area devastated by flooding. Religious hate crime is on the rise. In fact, it's increasing faster than any other form of hate crime in England and Wales, according to a new BBC investigation. Data from police forces show a 15% rise since 2019, driven largely by offences targeting Muslims and Jewish people. The rate of anti-Semitic hate crime rose by almost three-fifths, while anti-Muslim hate crime increased by over a quarter. Researchers warn that this type of crime is often underreported, and changes in the figures may reflect improved reporting and recording by police. Dr. Julian Hargreaves is a social scientist at City St. George's, University of London, who focuses on faith communities in the UK.
The new BBC data offer the public a fairly accessible way to gain insights into patterns of hate crime across the country. So some people might think that hate crime is a London problem or a Birmingham problem or a Manchester problem, which it is, of course, but it's also prevalent across England and Wales. So the data show us increases in hate crime from the north of England, counties outside London, down to the south, west, and across Wales. So these are really important insights. Secondly, I would say that these more local data offer us all a chance to reflect on the fact that behind each hate crime statistic is a human story, a real person who has called the police because they've either been physically assaulted, verbally abused, harassed, or feel threatened. And regardless of whether the police choose to investigate or prosecute or secure a conviction, we can be fairly sure that around these victims are families who feel concerned. And we know from decades of British criminology study that there are ripple effects through communities. And I think these new BBC data are a stark reminder of that.
And can you give us any kind of regional breakdown? Is it worse in some areas than others?
So I've been looking at some of the data over this weekend, and we've seen that there have been increases in anti-Jewish hate crime across North Yorkshire, where between 2022 and 2025, it increased by over three times. We've seen increases in Wales, as I mentioned, Gwent and South Wales, and in Surrey and in Avon and Somerset. In terms of anti-Muslim hate crime, we've seen increases in Northamptonshire, again in Avon and Somerset, again in Gwent, North Yorkshire and North Wales. So some concerning figures from across England and Wales.
And why do you think it's important to consider these figures together? I mean, each community will probably say that what they suffer is worse than the other community.
I think there are two reasons why we should consider these figures together. The first is that it makes good social science common sense, if you like, to compare groups. If you're thinking about a group in isolation, you raise questions such as, well, how does this compare within a wider context? How does this group compare with another group? Answering those questions provides really important information. I think there's another reason, though, which is perhaps as important, and that's if communities tackle these problems in isolation, I think they can often cut themselves off from wider debates and from opportunities to communicate with other communities. When communities come together around shared problems such as hate crime, they can often share ideas about tackling these problems and develop some of that common ground that is needed to bring faith communities together.
But how do you actually do that? That is the key question, isn't it? How do you bring these communities together to tackle these, you know, very, very strong and powerful feelings that are generating these hate crimes?
It's a really good question. There's no simple solution. Personally, I think that local community policing holds the key to bringing these local faith communities together. We know across the country there are initiatives from regional police forces which will bring communities together, which will discuss community problems, which deliver some of the protection to places of worship. I think again, you know, coming back to this idea of sort of sharing problems and sharing solutions is really important. And I think local community policing really holds the key to that.
Dr. Julian Hargreaves, and there'll be more detail on this story on BBC outlets across England and Wales tomorrow. You might think that everything that can be said about the great Dolly Parton has probably been said, but we do have a tribute from an American scholar of theology and ethics, Dr. Patrick Burrows, for whom Dolly and the theme park in her name, Dollywood, were a big influence on his life as a young gay Christian.
Love is like a butterfly, as soft and gentle as a sigh.
I grew up about an hour and a half away from her amusement park, Dollywood. And that was my, like, major encounter with her. My parents are not super country music fans, but Dollywood was a fixture. Anytime there was a trip, if our family was making a weekend trip during the school year or even during the summer, it would generally be to Dollywood. If there were church retreats, you know, youth group outings or whatever, it would often be to Dollywood.
Can you describe it? What is Dollywood like?
Oh, gosh. So Dollywood is an amusement park that has grown really substantially during my time. It was at one point a fairly small regional amusement park. It had a couple of roller coasters, but it was mostly a kind of a performing arts venue. There were lots of musicians in Dolly's own family, and so there are all of these stage shows. There's also, you know, standard fare, a rapids ride, a carnival set up.
But why was it so significant for you, though?
It was a retreat from the normal. It was a space really to enter into someone else's dreams. And Dolly, through Dollywood, really showed me extravagance. She showed me sort of what glitz and glam in her own sense of being over the top was, and that being over the top, being weird, being just too much a bit. I mean, the space that Dollywood is a space that's always been fairly welcoming and accepting, and kind of radically so. You know, I've said this in times before trying to explain this to people, but it is the gayest thing that a straight person has ever done. It was a museum to Dolly Parton in a theme park named after her, and it was full of wigs and memorabilia, her Kennedy Center honors, all of her dresses. There was even a, like, virtual video setup where you could dress yourself like Dolly and it would superimpose a wig on you.
Is that what you did?
Oh, of course, absolutely. And it was this sort of space of just extravagance. I think Dollywood is really the only place that I've experienced camp in its older sense. That is, that there's two communities in one space reading the same cultural artifact, but coming to wildly different appreciations and conclusions about it. And one, the group that is not reading from a camp sensibility, kind of having no sense that there's a doubleness of the way that this object can be read. And then the other relishing in the doubleness.
Although we had no money, why was rich as I could be? In my coat of many colors, my mama made for me.
The fact that she was a Christian as well, was that a revelation to you?
Dolly's been very, very upfront, or was very, very upfront throughout her whole life that she was a Christian. She published gospel music. It was not hard to find. There's a chapel on premises at Dollywood, the Robert F. Thomas Chapel, that is not available as a wedding venue. It is a worship space. You know, it's quite upfront, but people have called it the most conservative theme park in America. And that's in some ways also kind of true. But Dolly herself, her Christianity is much bigger than the kind of white Christian nationalism that often characterizes contemporary American evangelicalism.
Well, exactly. And that combination of being very, very open about gay lifestyle, mm-hmm. and deeply Christian was unusual at that time.
When Dolly in her 1992 autobiography or 94 autobiography speaks very lovingly about people that she knows who had died from AIDS, including one of her costume designers, it was in some ways kind of scandalizing for much of her Christian audience, who didn't really want to think about that. They didn't want to that didn't really even know how to compute that. And yet Dolly never apologized for that. You know, she famously said, I don't know that a gay person or a trans person can be different in any way that I could be different than Dolly Parton.
And what sort of effect or influence do you think she's had sort of long term on you? I mean, you're a scholar of theology and ethics. Yeah. How has she influenced you?
When people would call her a saint in her lifetime, she would always shut that down immediately. She would say, I'm not a saint. I'm a normal human being. I have all of the same flaws that anyone does. But people treated her that way. Her influence on me is certainly that of the merchandise that says, like, what would Dolly do?
It gave you a license to be exactly who you want to be. Is that it?
Absolutely. Dolly was insistent that God did not separate within her own self. She insisted that her sexuality was part of the person that God made her to be. That obviously is relevant for me, but also that this all was part of a religious vocation, of a religious call. How can you not be inspired by her? And here I go.
Patrick Burrows speaking to us there from North Carolina. Now, back to the devastation in Nepal and Tibet. The latest figures, at least 700 died in Nepal and more than 2,400 missing. One area severely affected is the Rasuwa district, north of Kathmandu, on the border with Tibet. It's been cut off from the rest of the country. It's populated by the Tamang people, who, amongst other jobs, guide and welcome pilgrims on remote trekking trails, including those heading to Mount Kailash in Tibet. The whole landscape is dotted with sacred lakes linked to Hinduism, Buddhism and indigenous religions. Professor Ben Campbell from Durham University is an anthropologist. He's been visiting this area since the 1980s, and he talked me through the powerful religious significance the region has, starting with the Trishuli River, which rose over 9 metres in some places, causing huge damage.
This is a key part of the landscape of the Hindu sacred Himalayan landscape. It's where the god Shiva, in old Hindu texts, he had a burning throat from swallowing poison from the churning of the oceans, and he went to strike his trident, that's called the Trisul, into the rocks of the Himalayas, and out gushed this cooling waters to calm his burning throat. So Hindus come up this way. Hindus, not just from Nepal, but from India. And it's likely that several of the people who've been lost in the terrible flood were pilgrims en route to Gozaikunda.
There are many pilgrims in the area. So it's a confluence of not just Hinduism, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a crossover sort of transitional land. When I first got to know the area, it was deemed kind of very different from the mainstream Nepalese culture and society. The people up there speak an indigenous language called Tamang, which is a kind of ancient Tibetan. They have different kinds of food, habits, forms of dress. Their religion is primarily Tibetan Buddhist. They cremate their dead on the ridgetops as opposed to what the Hindus do next to the water at the river ghats and that kind of thing. So Tamang people, they number about 2-3 million people, and they occupy the higher zones, higher up the mountains from where the Hindu Nepalese mainstream people live and grow rice. The Tamang people tend to grow dry crops and maize and keep livestock, cattle and yaks as well. So you're sort of getting into the Tibetan borderlands.
And the Tamang people themselves, for a long time, presumably they've helped other people who are coming to the area on pilgrimages and been part of that sort of religious life.
Exactly. And they provide the infrastructure of the, you know, conditions of possibility for the pilgrimage to take place. They make temporary tea shops and places to stay, have food. The Tamang communities, they profess to be Buddhist, if anything, but they also have shamans called Bombo. And the shamans, they come in troops of people with all their villagers in tow. They like get wish fulfillment if they go to the lake at the top. They can kind of ask for prosperous crops, fertile livestock, long life, money, good health, all these kinds of things. They get a direct connection with the god of the mountain. It's a kind of exuberant feeling. So there's excitement in the air. that goes along with the experience of the pilgrimage.
And do you think any of this can possibly help, perhaps, help them survive what's just happened to their community?
For now, they're shattered. They're absolutely shattered, and they're still counting who among their relatives are still missing or not accounted for. My, as it were, kind of godson, let's say, Michora in Nepali, he called me this morning and said that his first cousin is a truck driver, and he had been close to the Tibetan border, and he had just had to run for it. He lost his flip-flops. He went uphill as fast as he could. He scarred all over and finally got above the flood, but, you know, he had to be helicoptered out to the district capital, and from then on he's been helicoptered to Kathmandu. Right now, they're still trying to account for where are their relatives, who's been lost. Two villages further down from where I know people best, 95 people have been lost. And it's just unbelievable to them at this scale. But to answer your question, somehow or other, they're going to pull through. And they'll start with having to do all sorts of funeral mourning rituals, which usually happen 49 days, technically, after the death, using the Buddhist lamas to do the death ritual. But for those who are still alive, that's where they need the shamans.
And you've been visiting this area since the 1980s.
80s, yeah.
How do you feel seeing what's happened to it?
It's very shocking. And the thing is, people are wanting to get in touch, are wanting to, you know what much I know, and they want to call for help as well. The access to food supplies has now been cut off. In a few days, they're going to be running out of their supplies. So they're feeling cut off. They're feeling absolutely shocked themselves. I know there are colleagues at universities in the UK who are already thinking about assessing what's happened now. And I think hopefully we can come to some kind of network of expertise to know how to attend to what are the needs of the local people in this terrible time.
Professor Ben Campbell. And before we finish, we can have an update on the impact of the disaster from Stephen McDonald, who's in Beijing. Steve, tell us, what is the latest from your end?
Well, what we're getting from Chinese officials, like officials in the Tibetan Autonomous Region, it's all pretty grim news today, unfortunately. They're not finding anyone alive, according to officials in Shigatse, despite looking for days. That means that with 546 officially missing, including 261 foreigners on the Tibetan side of the border, in that region, the death toll is going to go up. And it's not without, for want of trying, that 2,141 People's Liberation Army and People's Armed Police and other rescue teams have gone in there using 269 vehicles, 4,000 pieces of equipment, and still they haven't been able to find anyone following that devastating wall of mud and water through
and
there.
And I understand there's new risk as well for more landslides?
Yes, well, they had been worried about a barrier lake, as it's called, which was formed by rocks and mud and other debris coming down the mountain and jamming in and creating a new lake, a barrier lake. Now, the fear was that that would burst open and there would be flash flooding. The good news on the front of that lake is that the water's been coming out of it slowly. That's what they want, gradual release of the water. But in the meantime, another collapse on the side of a mountain has created a new barrier lake, so more concerns. I think at some point that did mean they had to stop work initially, but that they are back at work again, the rescue teams. So despite how terrible and difficult it is with the rain coming down, that they are still looking for survivors.
And over the border in Nepal, we understand that the Nepali army has been working to try and rescue people trapped in a tunnel in a hydroelectric site. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, apparently also they have some assistance from Indian and Chinese teams trying to reach possibly more than 100 people who are alive in a tunnel. Others have been rescued from those hydropower tunnels. Now, earlier they managed to push through enough to pump some air in, and they tried to put some cameras down into the tunnel. But then the rain, again, apparently hampered this, And the rain also means potentially flooding in those tunnels, which is obviously terrible news because it might mean that those trapped in there, if there was anyone alive, that they could drown. So it is all pretty grim on that front too.
And the Foreign Minister is calling for help and saying the bill could run into billions of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, Nepal's a poor country. For anyone who's been there, they'll see that the infrastructure, you know, it's not fantastic. And so, they are going to need a lot of assistance to rebuild those remote mountain communities in Nepal. I mean, it's a much better situation for the Tibetan side of the border because the Chinese government, of course, has vast resources available to it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Steve McDonald there, the BBC correspondent. Well, that's it for this week's Sunday. I'll be here next week. And if you'd like to comment on today's programme, you can email us, sunday@bbc.co.uk. You can also listen again or download the programme as a podcast from the BBC Sounds app or follow us on social media. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Sunday was produced by Catherine Murray and Rebecca Kelly. Now, the broadcaster and ambassador for mesothelioma UK, Carolyn Quinn, presents this week's Radio 4 appeal on behalf of the charity.
Mesothelioma is a rare and incurable cancer, most often caused by exposure to asbestos. Widely used in construction until it was banned in the 1990s, it still remains in many buildings across the UK, including schools and hospitals. It can take many years after exposure before symptoms can develop. Take my mum. She was a fit and healthy 85-year-old when she was diagnosed and subsequently died from mesothelioma. We realised she'd come into contact with asbestos fibres decades earlier when washing out my builder dad's overalls. Then there's Martin, who lives in Stafford. Approaching his 70th birthday, he was fit, healthy, still working as a builder. But his life changed suddenly when what he thought was a persistent cough was the first symptom of mesothelioma. By then, the disease had already reached an advanced stage. He was told it wasn't possible to operate. His life expectancy was limited. Martin traces his asbestos exposure back to his teenage years, working as an apprentice joiner on a building site, regularly cutting asbestos sheets by hand and sweeping up the dust. He's now living with the consequences. His family searched for support and contacted Mesothelioma UK. Until then, he'd thought his treatment choices were limited. Then Martin was introduced to Lisa, one of the specialist mesothelioma nurses funded by the charity who work within NHS trusts across the UK. She helped Martin understand his condition and treatment options, including joining a clinical trial. After two cycles of treatment, scans showed that his tumour was shrinking. Now 71, Martin's feeling positive. He's spending precious time with his family. Mesothelioma UK wants to fund more specialist nurses like Lisa so that more people like Martin can access expert care wherever they live in the UK. It costs around £25,000 a year to fund a specialist nurse for 2 days a week in an NHS hospital. Around £35 can fund 1 hour of support. To donate, just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144, or you can write a cheque to Mesothelioma UK and send it to Free Post BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. Please remember to mark the back of your envelope Mesothelioma UK. Thank you.
Carolyn Quinn. That number again, 0800 404 8144. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles. You can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. If you want Mesothelioma UK to collect the gift aid on your donation, do include an email or postal address so that they can send you a gift aid declaration. Weather time now. Here with an update is Stab the Nails.
Thanks very much, John. Good morning to you. So part two of the weekend is looking pretty similar to what we had yesterday. It's going to be one of sunshine and showers. They really will get going as we head through the afternoon. As we head into Bank Holiday Monday, though, it looks like most of the showers will start to ease as a ridge of high pressure builds in. So it could be a little bit drier for part two of Monday, which is a bank holiday for all but Scotland. Today, though, for England, showers will start to become more widespread as we head through the morning and into the afternoon. We've had a decent start across large parts of Wales and in towards the Midlands and southern England. But those showers will get going, and like yesterday, some of them will turn out to be heavy and thundery. Looks like southeast England will stay driest for longest, with some sunny spells before showers rattle their way in later in the day. Temperatures across England, 19 to 22, but we could be up to 23 or 24 in the southeast, given more sunshine. For Wales, after that dry start, we will see the cloud and the showers developing. Again, they will be heavy and thundery into the afternoon. Some sunnier interludes in between, 19 to 22 Celsius. Northern Ireland also seeing scattered showers. These will be heavy at times, temperatures 16 to 19 Celsius. Scotland, quite a wet start through the central belt at the moment. And in the south, some of the rain heavy as well. That will tend to move away, and then we'll see sunshine and showers as well. Winds light across the northern half of the country, but we're looking at gustier southwesterly winds for South Wales, southwest England, gusting up to 40 miles an hour today. It'll be certainly windy across the south coast as we head into the evening as well. Tonight, the showers continue. Tomorrow, bank holiday. Showers, some of them heavy and thundery, but tending to ease as we head through the course of the day. John.
Thank you, Stav. Now for a look ahead to Broadcasting House at 9. Paddy O'Connell.
John.
Bit of rain.
Yes.
Lovely.
Lovely, isn't it?
Mm.
I've been standing in it.
smelling it.
Well, we are going to hear a new search for Britain's favourite hymns. Millions of us love singing together, but why does it always have to be Sweet Caroline as the anthem of the United Kingdom? On festival weekend, we've a live steel band, and we hear of new ways of cutting the queues for the ladies' loos. Now, the news this morning is coming from a BBC exclusive. The Prime Minister has told BBC Breakfast that PC Andrew Harper's killers will remain behind bars. He's announced changes to the early release scheme aimed at easing prison overcrowding. We've heard a lot about this on BH in recent weeks. We will listen to the Prime Minister and bring you a live briefing at 9 o'clock.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 30th of August. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. The killers of PC Andrew Harper will be blocked from the prison early release scheme under changes which will keep hundreds more criminals behind bars. Efforts to rescue workers trapped in tunnels in Nepal after Wednesday's floods are being hampered by heavy rain. And a new space telescope is to be launched on a mission to map more than a million galaxies and uncover distant planets. The Prime Minister has told the BBC that anyone convicted of an unlawful killing, which includes all forms of manslaughter, will be exempt from the prison early release scheme in England and Wales. In an exclusive interview with BBC Breakfast, Andy Burnham said the changes would keep hundreds of people behind bars, including the killers of PC Andrew Harper. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
Andy Burnham faced his toughest political test yet when it emerged that two of PC Andrew Harper's killers would be eligible for early release. The Prime Minister had already expanded the list of those not eligible to include some rapists and child sex offenders. He had suggested he couldn't go any further, but under pressure from victims' families, changed his mind. He told BBC Breakfast that hundreds more people would now stay behind bars.
Not just those guilty of manslaughter, but those convicted for indecent assault, for death by dangerous driving, all of these offenders now will remain in prison.
The Justice Secretary is expected to give a more precise number of prisoners affected when he updates MPs in Parliament on Tuesday. Mr. Burnham said he would free up space on the prison estate by deporting foreign criminals and releasing people on controversial indefinite sentences handed out in previous decades under public protection rules. But those measures will not create extra space for some time, meaning adult male prisons, currently operating at around 98% capacity, could get even busier.
More than 730 people are now known to have died in Nepal after Wednesday's devastating flash floods. Officials say that around 2,500 people are still missing, and rescue teams are warning that search efforts are being hampered by rain. Our South Asia correspondent, Azadeh Mashiri, reports from Kathmandu.
The forecast suggests the rain will continue until at least tomorrow, adding to an already challenging search and rescue operation. Many remain trapped in hydropower tunnels in northern Nepal, and thick mud is blocking rescuers from entering them. India and China have both sent experts to help. With hundreds of foreign nationals missing, aid is continuing to pour in. The United States has pledged $3.6 million in humanitarian assistance, while the United Kingdom has sent a rapid deployment team to Nepal to support British nationals. This is Nepal's worst disaster in more than a decade. Scientists believe the flash flood was triggered by a glacial collapse when all or part of a glacier disintegrates and led to catastrophic impacts downstream. Despite the scale of the disaster, thousands of people have been rescued. But as the search enters a fifth day, many of the families we meet tell us they're preparing for the worst.
Across the border in Tibet, Chinese state media say that 16 people have been confirmed dead. More than 500 others are still missing. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
Chinese state media reported that among the 546 people missing after Wednesday's landslide, 261 are foreigners from 23 countries, including 15 British nationals. Rescue teams searching through mud and debris at the Tibetan border, the main crossing point for tourists heading from Kathmandu to the sacred Mount Kailash, have so far found no survivors. State media said teams have had to be moved to safety after yet another landslide in the area. It was spotted by a drone and it appears to have formed another lake among the debris downstream from an existing body of water that has been a concern for days. The report says experts are currently assessing the risk it may pose.
Police in Switzerland say that multiple shots have been fired near a rave in the northern town of Aarau. One person has been killed and five are seriously injured. There's a large police presence at the scene at a racecourse. Early results in Iceland's referendum on whether to resume talks on joining the European Union indicate that the decision is on a knife edge and is too close to call. Iceland is already part of the EU's single market and Schengen border-free zone, and membership would bring it into the customs union too, David Bamford reports.
Icelanders have been staunchly independent since a 1944 referendum ended their union with Denmark. But when the country's banking system collapsed following the global financial crisis of 2008, a left-wing government championed joining the European Union. Accession talks opened and advanced quickly. However, in 2013, a new Eurosceptic government suspended the process, saying Iceland could lose control of its vital fisheries. Today, it faces greater geopolitical and financial pressures and a centre-left government urging the population to resume the accession process.
East Midlands Railway is advising passengers to travel only if necessary today because of strike action. Members of the RMT are walking out in a dispute about safety. EMR is running what it calls a significantly reduced service to and from London, with the strike continuing into tomorrow. NASA is due to launch a new telescope later, which the space agency says will help it to study more than a billion galaxies and to look at distant planets. The first images from the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope are expected early next year. Here's our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
Dr. Nancy Grace Roman was warned off physics by teachers who told her it was not for girls. She ignored them, started her own astronomy club at age 11, and went on to become NASA's first chief astronomer in 1960. Soon, her namesake will be a million miles from Earth, scanning the skies with Hubble, the space telescope she made possible. The Roman Space Telescope has a mirror the same size as Hubble's, so its pictures will be just as sharp, but importantly, its camera has a wider field of view, so sees at least 100 times more sky at once. Its five-year mission is to map more than a billion galaxies and uncover 100,000 strange new worlds.
And a Finnish performer has shredded some invisible strings to become the air guitar world champion for a second year in a row.
Ladies and gentlemen, with a score of 34.8 from Finland, the Angel!
Arpo, the Angus Ratio, stole the show in Oulu in Finland, beating 50 entries from 13 countries around the world. The British comedian Sam Nicoresti was the UK's hopeful. She won the Best Comedy Show at last year's Edinburgh Fringe. Well, that's the news. Now for a look at the Sunday papers. The Sunday Telegraph this morning says the Chancellor, John Healey, is mulling a windfall tax on banks and oil companies in the budget. Treasury officials are said to be looking at ways of plugging a £4.7 billion black hole without raising direct taxes on individuals. The paper suggests banks and oil companies are seen as low-hanging fruit. BP is said to have more than doubled its profits between April and June because of the high oil prices caused by the Iran war. In its editorial, the paper warns against the windfall tax move, saying that it will harm growth by denting investor confidence. According to the Mail on Sunday, Russia is poised to target Britain with a cyber attack on a drone or missile factory. A key adviser to President Putin, the former Deputy Foreign Minister Andrei Fedorov, tells the paper the highest levels of the Russian government are considering such a strike. A drone factory owned by the British-Ukrainian firm Ukrspec Systems is said to be the target. Its location, near RAF Mildenhall in Suffolk, was made public in April. The Sunday Times reports that Andy Burnham has given what it calls a lucrative pay rise to train drivers on the Avanti London to Manchester line. The deal with union leaders was said to have been made to avoid strikes on a flagship service and one of the busiest lines in Europe. The paper suggests industrial action would have proved embarrassing for cabinet ministers travelling to the Prime Minister's new political hub, No. 10 North, in Manchester. According to both the Sunday Telegraph and the Sunday People, new studies suggest that statins can reduce the risk of dementia, as well as lowering cholesterol and the risk of heart attacks. The Telegraph reports that the largest study by Denmark's Copenhagen University Hospital found that the daily pills reduced the chances of dementia by up to 15%. The paper says the research means statins could benefit around 6 million of almost 10 million people aged 70 and over in the UK who are not currently taking them. The Sunday Mirror reports that Peter Homer, the ex-boss of Nottingham NHS Trust, where a review found that 520 mothers or babies suffered potentially avoidable death or harm, is now CEO of a firm giving maternity training to the health service. Grieving families tell the paper they are concerned by the news. Mr. Homer was approached for comment. And finally, The Sun on Sunday suggests The X Factor could return 7 years after it left our screens. ITV chiefs are said to be in talks about revamping the programme for a younger generation. A look at some of Sunday's newspapers.
Charles Carroll. This is BBC Radio 4. Sunday Worship Today is the first of four special programmes which, over the next few months, will explore pathways and pilgrimage routes along the coastlines of the United Kingdom. Today comes from Northern Ireland and takes us to Strangford Lock in County Down and the ancient monastic site of Nendrum.
My name is Martin McGill, and until recently, I was parish priest of St John's on the Falls Road in Belfast. As you listen to this service, I'm presently on sabbatical.
And I'm Simon Dugan, Church of Ireland Rector of Ballyhome by the Sea. Welcome to Sunday Worship from the ancient Christian site of Nendrum in County Down.
The water you hear is one of the few things that hasn't changed since Nendrum's glory days. We're in a sheltered inlet of Strangford Loch, a curving sea arm cutting deep into the east coast of Northern Ireland, blessed with many islands. The largest is Mahi, after a young convert of St Patrick, Muchi, who founded a monastery here in the 5th century.
Today's route of narrow lanes and causeways to get here makes Nendrum feel like the end of the earth. 1,500 years ago, it was anything but. A busy community of prayer and the seat of a bishop, this was a maritime monastery with ready sea access to coastal Ireland and Northern Britain.
So the question is, Simon, Are we visiting Christians arriving on ecclesiastical business? Or are we making a pilgrimage or retreat? Maybe we're prospective novices here to test our vocation, or just wayfarers hoping for Christian hospitality.
On the other hand, Martin, we could be bloodthirsty young Vikings on a longboat raid. After all, a Danish assault launched from this very shore in 974 saw Nendram attacked and pretty much destroyed.
But there's another possibility, suggested by Nendram's three circular stone walls or castles, that people came here to seek forgiveness for their sins. Picture Nendram as a low-rise wedding cake with three defined circular spaces situated one on top of the other.
As we make our way prayerfully this morning through outer, middle and inner enclosures, we will retrace the timeless pathway open to all believers that brings us closer to God and closer to one another. We will also reflect as we go on both our Catholic and Reformed traditions and their shared roots in an earlier Jewish one.
We begin now with a Celtic calm prayer. Calm is Irish for encompassing. Having no beginning or end, circles pointed to God's love in eternity, which moved early Irish Christians to speak of God's protective, circling presence. Let us pray.
Circle us, Lord. Keep love within, keep hatred out. Keep joy within, keep fear out. Keep peace within, keep worry out. Keep light within, keep darkness out. May you stand in the circle with us today and always. Amen.
Oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus, vast unmeasured, boundless free.
We've made our way up from the shore to the monastery's outer enclosure. And in early Christian Ireland, the distinction between clerics and monks and the laity could be fuzzy. Lay penitents and tenant farmers seem to have shared a monastic life to a large extent. In that spirit, it's not just Martin and me at Nandrum this morning.
Indeed not, Simon. Today we're joined for our readings and prayers by
Joan Warrington from the local Church of Ireland parish of Killinchy, Kilmood and Tullinakil.
And I'm Carol Black from the local Catholic parish of Newton Ards and Cumber.
Glad you're both with us.
Up from the shore, we're in the monastery's outer enclosure, and our first reading makes sense right here. If Nandrum shines a gospel light in a tiny western corner of the European Dark Ages, ancient Israel in its bleakest years is brought hope by the priest and prophet Ezekiel.
To a helpless exiled people, Ezekiel's vision is of a land restored by a just and holy God and a temple reconstructed in three distinct sections, entrance, nave, and inner room.
Then he brought me to the nave and measured the pilasters. On each side, 6 cubits was the width of the pilasters. The width of the entrance was 10 cubits, and the side walls of the entrance were 5 cubits on either side. He measured the length of the nave, 40 cubits, and its width, 20 cubits. Then he went into the inner room and measured the pilasters of the entrance, 2 cubits, and the width of the entrance, 6 cubits, and the side walls of the entrance, 7 cubits. He measured the depth of the room, 20 cubits, and its width, 20 cubits beyond the nave. And he said to me, "This is the most holy place."
Over 8 chapters, Ezekiel offers a highly detailed guided tour of Solomon's temple. Before his exile and the temple's destruction in 587 BC, Ezekiel probably served as priest there. Later, as a prophet, he offered an oracle of hope for a people at their lowest ebb.
A resurgence of Israel's fortunes, Ezekiel submits, will only come through a resurgence of Israel's faith. Their relationship with God must be revitalized. Other threefold temples predating Ezekiel's include a Canaanite example from the 13th century and an 8th century temple in northern Syria.
But what's way more startling, moving from the 6th century BC to the 6th century AD, is that the greatest concentration of so-called concentric curvilinear monastic enclosures in Europe is found in Ireland, Nandrum being one of them.
It turns out that the Irish clerics identified so strongly with the tradition that they modelled their Christian communities directly on Ezekiel's tripartite Jerusalem temple. There's also clear evidence of an older Christian practice of strict purity regulations.
In this period, penitentials or tariff books began to be written in Ireland for clerics, monks and the laity alike. These books listed sins and prescribed specific acts of penance and reparation. So much time fasting, so many prayers to say, all in order to get right with God.
Modern Christian sensibilities balk at the formal, regulated holiness once dispensed in church history, and abuses like indulgences to which they gave rise. Certainly it was one of the driving complaints of the Protestant reformers in the early 1500s. But in their original Irish setting, the tariff books were aimed to show that no one was beyond the healing love of God.
Martin, I think it's fair to say that general confession at the start of worship and then an annual focus on Advent and Lent is shared by both our traditions.
One of the most moving parts of my ministry as a priest has been celebrating the sacrament of reconciliation. It's a profound privilege to witness the courage with which people bring hidden burdens into the light of God's mercy. I'm conscious that the forgiveness offered is not mine. I'm there as a minister of Christ's mercy. Again and again I've seen people arrive burdened by guilt or regret and leave with renewed freedom and peace. That, for me, is the heart of confession. Not humiliation or punishment, but reconciliation, healing and a new beginning.
In my Reformed tradition, many believers testify to a growing personal conviction of sin as part of their original journey to Christian commitment in the first place. That foundational experience of Christ's forgiveness then involves into a lifetime of sanctification, where holiness is a byproduct of being disciples in the world. So we would both want to say, I think, Martin, confession truly could never be a transactional encounter with the Saviour, rather a relational one, brokenheartedness on our side, loving compassion on Christ's, something like the prayer we'll be led in now.
Jesus, forgive me my sins. Forgive the sins that I can remember, and also the sins I have forgotten. Forgive the wrong actions I have committed, and the right actions I have omitted. Forgive the times I have been weak in the face of temptation, for those when I have been stubborn in the face of correction. Forgive the times I have been proud of my own achievements, and those when I have failed to boast of your works. Forgive the harsh judgments I have made of others, and the leniency I have shown to myself. Forgive the lies I have told to others, and the truths I have avoided. Forgive me the pain I have caused others, and the indulgence I have shown to myself. Jesus, have pity on me and make me whole. Amen.
Ezekiel's temple in its city setting included entrance buildings for use by the priests and for storage. The self-contained rural setting of Nendrum required more basic amenities. We've now climbed to the middle enclosure, and you get a sense of what was once below us. Farming and fields, cattle and crops, huts for the farmers and labourers, a kiln, and even a tide mill.
Alongside workshops and a bronze smith's hut, a stone rectangle marks the site of Nendrum's school, which may have doubled as a scriptorium where manuscripts were copied. Iron and styluses were unearthed there with flat stone trial pieces, some scratched with Christian cross designs, others with incised knot patterns illustrating the Holy Trinity.
It's a character, of course, nowadays, to say that whereas Catholic churches are richly decorated, Protestant churches are bare and unadorned. Yet craft and creativity plainly spilled over into Nendrum's worshipping life, as they did centuries earlier in Ezekiel's temple in Jerusalem.
Facing the threshold, the temple was panelled with wood all round, from the floor up to the windows. Now, the windows were covered. To the space above the door, even to the inner room and on the outside. And on all the walls, all round in the inner room and the nave, there was a pattern. It was formed of cherubim and palm trees, a palm tree between cherub and cherub. Each cherub had two faces. A human face turned towards the palm tree on one side, and the face of a young lion turned towards the palm tree on the other side. They were carved on the whole temple all round, from the floor to the area above the door. Cherubim and palm trees were carved on the wall. In front of the holy place was something resembling an altar of wood. 3 cubits high, 2 cubits long, and 2 cubits wide. Its corners, its base, and its walls were of wood. He said to me, "This is a table that stands before the Lord."
Metalworking was one of the crafts at Nendrum. A bronze-dipped iron handbell was found at Nendrum here in the 1920s. Regularly throughout the day, the bell was rung from the top of the tower on the level above us.
Nendrum's round tower, or bell tower, was both a landmark for miles around and something of a monastic status symbol. The temple in Jerusalem had its treasuries. Irish monasteries had their round towers.
Everything in Nendrum points to prayer as a fundamental part of the people's response to God's divine initiative. A stone sundial, which was also discovered in the 1920s, indicated when the bell should be rung.
The divisions of daylight on that now reconstructed sundial, where we're headed next, mark not the 24 hours of the clock, but the hours when the monks turn from their manual work around the site to their work of prayer in the church.
We've made our way to the door of the ruins of the community church, and we're going to be led at the sundial in our prayers by Carol and by Joan.
God of earth, sea and sky, in this place where all three touch, we pray for harmony in creation. With soaring temperatures wreaking havoc this summer, may the sirens and alarm bells sounding now around the globe alert us to damage already done and the threat of worse to come. Source of all being, whose glory nature heralds, teach us, Lord, how to walk the earth more gently, treat the sea more responsibly, fly the sky more cautiously, and follow Christ's example of sacrifice in all we do.
God of nations, governments and communities, in this land where walls sometimes separate, we pray for an end to division. With suspicion and mistrust often ready to lash out, may the fear and resentment that turns ugly on our streets shame the hatred that lurks in all our hearts and the hostility that sometimes boils over in others. Source of all love, your Son proved ally to every reject. Grant us, Lord, healing among the nations, wisdom for the governments, friendship in our communities, and the light of Christ's truth on every situation.
God of family, friends, and loved ones, in this silence, where the joy and sorrow of life still echo, we pray for those in need. With despair, loss, and worry seemingly all around us, may our ears be open to the cries of the forlorn, that we may hear their pain, feel their hurt, and reach out in ready response. Source of all care, your Spirit waits to anoint every wound. Stir us, Lord, from coldness to shared feeling, from self-absorption to concern for others, from indifference to practical acts of kindness, and to the comfort and hope Christ alone can bring. Attended on you,
religious communities have sought to obey Christ's command to welcome the stranger. But access to the monastery's inner or central enclosure was restricted. The round tower, the abbot's house, the cemetery, and the church were standing outside now weren't just the monk's inner sanctum, they were Nendrum's spiritual and ritual core.
In Ezekiel's time, purity was required to enter the sanctuary. Ezekiel's hope was that ritual cleansing by water would be accompanied by the creation of a new heart and a new spirit. The early church included Jews who had become Christians, but who were still practicing Jews, and so they began to iron out a workable theology of ritual and spiritual purity.
Acts chapter 15 includes a famous letter from the Jerusalem Council written for Gentile believers at Antioch around the year 50 AD.
For it has seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to impose on you no further burden than these essentials, that you abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from fornication. If you keep yourselves from these, you will do well. Farewell. So they were sent off and went down to Antioch. When they gathered the congregation together, they delivered the letter. When its members read it, they rejoiced at the exhortation.
Those verses from Acts have been described as a first marker of a Christian tradition of Gentile ritual purity.
For the writer of the letter to the Hebrews, on the other hand, the death and resurrection of Jesus meant that the Temple of Jerusalem had been superseded. The pursuit of ritual purity, moreover, could be abandoned wholesale.
Therefore, my friends, since we have confidence to enter the sanctuary by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us approach with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who has promised is faithful.
These two strands, the demands that members of the church live pure and holy lives, alongside the conviction that we are redeemed by God's grace alone, will run throughout Christian history.
Despite opposition in the Latin West from doctrinal giants like St. Jerome and St. Augustine, the early Irish church seems to have been influenced by an emphasis on purity that was more characteristic of the Christian Greek East, which brings us back to the reason some Christians visited Nendrum in the first place, to seek forgiveness for their sins.
The Christian heart naturally asks, who among us, having been touched by the love of God, does not long for more? We want that love to fill more and more of our hearts and lives, bringing light and warmth, especially to those parts of ourselves that remain wounded, fearful, or closed.
Ezekiel understood that external purity is not enough. Again, within Reformed spirituality, holiness is a side effect of growing closer to the God who made us, redeemed us, and will finally welcome us home. It's a lifelong journey whose trajectory is towards the holy, the holier, and the holiest.
We've stepped at last inside the open-air ruins of Nendrum's church. Eventually, a series of wooden structures was replaced with a stone building. To modern eyes, the nave looks small, but 100 monks are thought to have squeezed in here.
For sure, many would describe Nendrum as a thin place where the earthly and spiritual boundary blurs, heaven touches earth, and God feels near. It's certainly a place where prayer has been valid, even after the earliest monastery ceased to function. Nendrum's worship continued as a parish church until the 16th century.
But its serenity today belies the spiritual striving and soul-searching built into its very stones. Which brings us to the Bible's final temple picture in Revelation. Depicting the heavenly city, Revelation insists that the blood of Jesus grants access to the one true sanctuary, which belongs to the people of the new covenant.
Revelation 21, verses 16 to 22. The wall is built of jasper, while the city is pure gold, clear as glass. The foundations of the wall of the city are adorned with every jewel. and the 12 gates are 12 pearls. Each of the gates is a single pearl, and the street of the city is pure gold, transparent as glass. I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb.
That's a vision Christians of every persuasion are grateful to claim. One after another, the barriers which separate humankind from God are removed until nothing remains to come between God and his people. Ultimately, the New Jerusalem has no temple. God and the Lamb is the temple.
To go back to Ezekiel, it's surely revealing that the former temple priest and prophet insists he never entered the temple's inner room or most holy place. Perhaps he didn't need to. By contrast, there's evidence to suggest that on completion of their fasting and prayer, penitential visitors to monasteries like Nendrum did eventually make it to the altar.
Cross-marked grave slabs nearby suggest that for some, Nendrum was a final destination. For more, though, probably even for most, it was a spiritual staging post. The original flagged stone pathway which leads to the door of this church also leads away. Indeed, from Nendrum and other nearby shores, monks set sail with their manuscripts for permanent exile in continental Europe.
God brought people here, and God sent them on from here, as he sends us on today. Yes, Nendrum represents an interval, a time for rest and healing. Yet it also represents a time of testing, of inviting God to cleanse our inner desires so that our perspective changes and we see the world differently.
Crucially, God goes with us. And so we end, as we started, with another Trinitarian circling or calm prayer. Christians sometimes turn gently clockwise as they prayed the calm, drawing three circles around themselves with their index finger to involve their whole selves, body, mind, soul and spirit, and to express their sense that God was in the circle with them. We pray together. Bless to me the sky that is above me.
Bless to me the ground that is beneath me.
Bless to me the friends who are around me.
Bless to me the love of the three.
Deep within me and encircling me. Amen.
Thank you.
Sicut Cebus by Palestrina ends today's Sunday worship, which came from the Nendrum monastic site at Strangford Lock in County Down and was led by Father Martin McGill and Canon Simon Dugan. The producer was David Walker. Next week, Sunday worship will be a service to mark the 25th anniversary of 9/11 from churches on either side of Ground Zero, St Paul's and St Nicholas in New York. And Sunday worship returns to the holy coastlines of the UK in 2 weeks' time with a visit to the coast of North Wales. That's at the usual time of 8:10 on BBC Radio 4. Throughout this coming Thursday, Radio 4 has a very particular historical focus.
Normandy on BBC Radio 4.
The Bayeux Tapestry revisits the UK after almost 1,000 years.
It's a symbol of friendship between the two countries now.
To chart this landmark occasion, we're taking a day to examine the enduring legacy of the Norman conquest.
How does this connect with what I'm speaking right now? Are these words I'm saying mostly English, mostly Norman French, or what?
Looking at linguistics, food and culture.
Norman influence is all around us, from our landscape to our architecture.
Norman Day.
This Thursday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The conquest brought a trilingual era, and Michael Rosen will explore what that meant then and its relevance today in Word of Mouth on Thursday afternoon at 3:30. Now, history told by the people who were there. Witness history with Lars Bavanga.
Today, I'm taking you back to the early hours of the 5th of May 1942 and a Norwegian village near Trondheim. The country's been under Nazi German occupation for 2 years. Now, a team of Norwegian resistance fighters are about to carry out what the Allied forces see as the top priority sabotage operation in Norway at this stage of the war. One local family will become central to the action.
The first sabotage was planned by my grandfather, because he was an electrical engineer. He was responsible for the maintenance of all the electrical equipment for the everything around the mining industry up there.
That's Gunnar Deinbol Jensen. He grew up hearing how his uncle, Lieutenant Peter Deinbol, his mother Lita, and his grandfather, Peter Senior, all became instrumental in trying to stop the Germans from extracting copper and sulfur from a mine near their village of Urkanger and shipping it to Germany. Both minerals were needed in weapons production. The Norwegian government in exile and its British allies were in no doubt what needed to be done.
This was ranked as number one. It was the most important target for the Allies. It represented 25% of the sulfur the Germans could get hold on. And that's a lot of explosives and bombs and bullets that could have killed the Allies.
Electric trains carried the sulfur from the mine down to the harbour in Utganger. On this early May morning in 1942, to halt that transport, the saboteurs set out to blow up the heavily guarded transformer that secured the train line's electricity supply. Gunnar's uncle Petter led the operation.
It was located on near the harbour, down at the end of Orkanger. And he knew the area well. I've been there as a kid myself. It's an intense humming sound in the transformer. They were seven in all, saboteurs. They had different tasks. Some watched the guards. And a couple of them went in.
Lieutenant Deinbol's team were under immense pressure. Not only was the operation very dangerous, if they failed, Allied aircraft would carpet bomb the valley and village to end the German transport.
And that would have killed a lot of people, because it wasn't a precision bombing at the time.
The area near the transformer station was heavily guarded. Some 200 German soldiers were stationed within 250 metres of it. A smaller team of three managed to sneak past, and they only had one local Norwegian guard to deal with inside the station itself.
They knocked him down and gagged him, yeah. And they put a 1,000 kroner in his pocket as a compensation. Uncle Petter that led the sabotage, he sent the others away. He was going to set off the blast.
Lieutenant Petter Deinbol used a timing device to give him a 20-minute head start to escape from the transformer station before the explosives went off. But the device took longer than expected.
And he waited for the blast to go off, and nothing happened. And there were guards there, you know, he had to crawl back. When he almost got to the door, it all exploded. So he was thrown to the ground, and he started running when he could get on his feet again. And he ran up steep hills. He had played the hide-and-seek up there as a kid. He had the Germans right behind him. And at one point, he was hanging over a rock cliff, and they stepped on his fingers so close, but still didn't find him. And he was dodging them up there for 7 hours, and he fled over the mountains to Sweden.
Meanwhile, the rest of the team had managed to flee on bicycles towards Trondheim. While running for his life, Gunnar's uncle Petter also knew that if the German soldiers caught him, his own family and other locals who had been helping behind the scenes were at risk.
They left some artifacts, like coins, indications that there had been British troops there who were responsible for the sabotage, because they knew that the Germans would hit back on the local civil population to deter further sabotage.
Blowing up the electricity supply put a stop to the trains for a while. When the Germans repaired it and resumed the shipment of sulfur, Lieutenant Petter Deinbol and his team planned and executed further attacks on a boat in the harbour and on the train's locomotives. All the while, they were supported by locals, including Deinbol's own family.
And the locals came with food. My mother came with information, intelligence. She helped with the explosives, transport of that and of the guns. Nobody suspected a young, sweet girl, 16, 17, and she could pass the German guards without being noticed.
Yet suspicion grew around the Deinbol family.
They realized that there was talk in the town that maybe the Deinbol family was involved in these sabotages. So they were always had prepared an escape kit with the necessary things to escape. And they had planned a route for escape. In the end, they got a notification from the local sheriff that the Germans were onto them. They had to get away.
Gunnar's mother and grandfather skied over the mountains to neutral Sweden. From there, they travelled to London, where both ended up assisting the exiled Norwegian government. Meanwhile, the saboteurs had finally managed to blow up all but one locomotive on the train line from the mine to the harbour. The German export of copper and sulphur came close to total collapse. For the Deinbol family, it was not all good news, however. Lieutenant Petter Deinbol perished in a plane crash over the North Sea shortly before the final operation. On the 7th of May 1945, the government and royal family returned to a liberated Norway. Crowds lined the streets singing the national anthem, as heard in this radio clip kept by the Norwegian National Library. Gunnar's family also headed home, but for them, the celebrations would not last.
Well, they returned to Norway with the Norwegian exile government and the king on his ship in through the Oslo Fjord. And then they took off to their home further north in Norway in Orkanger. When they arrived there, my grandfather went to his former boss and said, I'll take up my work again. He was yelled at for having hurt the company Orkla. He was sacked.
The mining company had been dependent on the German market even before the war and increased production of sulfur and copper during the occupation. In 2003, at a ceremony attended by representatives from the Orkla company, a bust of Lieutenant Petter Deinbol was unveiled near where the first sabotage took place.
That was the first time we, as a family, got an apology from Orkla. The Norwegian army was also present, which was very good to be part of for my mother, for my family and for me.
Gunnar Danebol Jensen's mother, Lita, died during the pandemic in 2020.
The presenter was Lars Buvanga, and for more memorable moments told by the people who were there, just search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. Now, produced by Sophie Anton, Tweet of the Day with Jasmine Donahay.
It's hot and dry, and I'm thirsty and exhausted, when in the distance I hear mallards. Instantly, I feel refreshed, because this sound announces the hidden presence of water. That familiar quack, which carries across a distance, is the female's voice. The word quack itself might derive from her call. In spring and summer, there are so many errant peeping ducklings for the females to corral. And for those ducklings that venture too far, terrible dangers lurk everywhere. Inadvertently, the females may also help protect the males. When male mallards lose their flight feathers and showy colours after breeding, they take refuge among the females, whose camouflaged plumage is like a sun-dappled riverbed or brown streaky reeds submerged in a current. But the male's softer voices give them away. Wherever there's water, mallards are likely to be dabbling or preening.